We'll begin by opening a public hearing on both House Bill 3547 and House Joint Resolution 56. Council, and then we'll have Representative Cameron give us some introductory remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Oregon's free speech provision, Article 1, Section 8 of the Oregon Constitution, provides, quote, "No law shall be passed restraining the free expression of opinion or restricting the right to speak, write, or print freely on any subject whatsoever, but every person shall be responsible for the abuse of this right." It prohibits public bodies, in the words of the Oregon Supreme Court, from enacting restrictions that focus on the content of speech or writing, either because the content itself is deemed socially undesirable or offensive, or because it is thought to have adverse consequences. However, governmental bodies may restrain expression if the drafters of the Constitution intended, in 1859, to allow governmental bodies to restrain that type of expression. The Supreme Court applied that test to an ordinance that regulated nude dancing in the 2005 case City of Nisa versus Dufloth, concluding that nude dancing qualified as expression within the meaning of Article 1, Section 8, and there was no evidence that the drafters of the Constitution intended to place that expression outside the provision's reach. House Joint Resolution 56 would amend the Constitution to permit state or local governments to regulate any strip act to the extent allowed by the federal Constitution. It defines strip act to mean, quote, "a performance in which a person or persons appear nude or partially nude, or in which a person or persons become nude or partially nude, before one or more patrons of a club or business enterprise, before one or more customers of the person or persons, or before one or more members of the public." It also permits government to establish a more detailed definition to implement the amendment or conform it with the federal Constitution.
Thank you, Council. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and esteemed members and colleagues. It's great to be here today to introduce this bill to you. And I want to make a couple things clear that HJR 56 and its companion bill, HB 3547, are companion bills in the fact that they go together. It's an amendment that would allow the state or local governments to use their regulatory authority to restrict strip club acts to the extent allowed under the United States Constitution. This amendment is limited to regulating strip clubs and does not include other adult establishments. And I really want to make this clear that this does not say that there should not be strip clubs. It just gives local authority and the people of our state the ability to say and have input as to what those strip clubs would look like and maybe where they would be located. September 29th in 2005, the Oregon Supreme Court in a decision overturned the conviction of the crime of promoting a live sex show. In a separate court ruling, the court also found the City of Nisa ordinance requiring a 4-foot buffer between nude dancers and patrons unconstitutional. In one fell swoop, the Oregon Supreme Court has declared that live sex acts as constitutionally protected freedom of speech and restricted local communities from making good decisions for its citizens. The court's interpretation of Oregon's free expression law establishes protections far beyond what the United States Constitution guarantees. This bill is an attempt to balance the important civil liberties while at the same time giving people the options to keep their children and communities protected and safe. And I'd like to refer to an article that was published by the Associated Press September 30th of 2005, and just a couple of quotes from that. Justice Michael Gillette, who wrote the majority opinion, said, quote, "appears to us to be beyond reasonable dispute that the protection extends to the kind of expression that a majority of citizens in many communities would dislike, and even to physical acts such as nude dancing and other explicit sexual conduct that have an expressive component." And the last quote, who is now our Chief Justice, Paul DeMunis, said he didn't believe that masturbation and sexual intercourse in a live public show is, quote, is a form of speech that the drafters of the Oregon Constitution sought to protect. Appreciate your time and your attention today to this important priority for the people of the state of Oregon.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Cameron. I'd like next to call up a panel of four people, Rob Drake, Jane Dahl, T.J. Sullivan, and Scott Winkle. And I'll let you decide among yourselves who and what order you should present.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkle is representing the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in favor of HJR 56. I wanted to, with me today are Mayor Drake, Mayor of Beaverton, and T.J. O'Sullivan, councillor from Salem. And I will be brief, because I think their experiences in this matter is very telling. But I first wanted to go through what would and would not be allowed should HJR 6 pass the legislature and be approved by the voters. The Supreme Court has spelled out in City of Renton versus Playtime Theaters, Inc. et al. What is the extent that this sort of expression could be regulated by by a city. The facts of the case are that if some theater owners wish to show adult videos, City of Renton, Washington, had an ordinance that prohibited such showings within 1,000 feet of a school, residential neighborhoods, or other places that churches, parks, schools, or other places children might congregate. The district court held the city's favor, so the appeals court reversed, and the Supreme Court upheld the ruling. And what the Supreme Court said is that since the ordinance was content neutral, the ordinance wasn't designed to regulate the speech, it was designed to deal with the secondary effects, other criminal activity that takes place around some of these establishments, negative impacts on the retail business in the downtown sector, and those sorts of things. Secondly, a substantial government interest was served by the ordinance, which was the protection of community livability. And third, the ordinance also allowed for reasonable alternative avenues of communication. So a city could not zone entirely through the zoning process, eliminate these sorts of establishments. The ordinance would have to provide for an alternative compliance. In the Renton case, I believe they had 520 acres that would be available to for the locating of these sorts of establishments. excuse me. So with that, I would like to turn it over to Mayor Drake.
Thank you, Scott. Mr. Chairman, committee members, good morning. I'm Rob Drake. I serve as the mayor of Beaverton, and for reference, served as president of the League of Cities in 2003. With me today is Jane Dahl, who's the board chair of the Beaverton Area Chamber of Commerce, and I'll ask her to comment briefly after I do. The city supports HJR 56, and we appreciate Representative Cameron bringing this forward. There have been a couple measures in the last, give or take, 14 years that Oregon voters have not approved, and we believe that the message in opposition to it did not fully recognize that who was opposing the measure, and specifically it was the smut industry that supplied about 95% of the funding to oppose that measure. We think it gives voters the ability to vote on the subject if you send this forward, and it would give communities a chance to help limit the negative impacts caused by the new dancing industry. I've included a letter that cites reasons why, for business purposes, why we think HJR 56 is a good idea, and it also highlights the impact that new dancing, and I recognize that this is specifically about exotic or new dancing and not print media, but it highlights the impact that these businesses are having in Beaverton. There are currently two new dancing establishments in Beaverton. At one point, one that has since closed caused a great impact in our downtown area, including on more than one occasion patrons from that new dancing establishment running across the street, urinating, fighting, etc., at the Honda dealership. And more than once, the owner of that dealership called me and asked what we were going to do to stop what was happening there. On more than one occasion, also, bouncers were seen chasing patrons from that new dancing establishment across Canyon Road, literally between customers and the salesperson, and then fighting just a few feet beyond the salesperson and the customers. I'd like to also note that we've had multiple conversations with property owners and businesses nearby these two new dancing establishments, indicating that property values have declined. They've had difficulties renting their facilities. And lastly, of course, as I think you can understand, difficulty having customers utilize these businesses that are either adjacent to or nearby these business establishments. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions and then turn it over to Jane.
I think we'll hear from all the members of the panel and then open it up for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Dahl.
Thank you for allowing me to be here today. I am Jane Dahl, and I'm the chair of the Beaverton Area Chamber of Commerce Board, and we represent over 800 businesses in the Beaverton area. And I'm here today to support HJR 56. I work for IBM full-time as a communications manager. I've been in the Beaverton area for 16 years and have a young teenage daughter who goes to school in the downtown Beaverton area. And like other Beaverton citizens, we have strong family values that are focused on the quality of life in Beaverton. And for the last 7 years, we've seen major redevelopment in downtown Beaverton, revitalizing the downtown area so citizens and tourists can enjoy comfortably and safe areas like our new library, the Round, the Cedar Hill Shopping Mall. Adult entertainment establishments, though allowed, inhibits our economic growth of the downtown Beaverton area and our businesses. Beaverton is a transportation nexus, and the Beaverton-Hillsdale Highway and the Canyon Road are the main thoroughfares to connect 217 and 26. Over the past decade, multiple entertainment places have changed the downtown core, encroaching on our regional center of Beaverton. And citizens and tourists just won't travel or walk these areas, and our businesses are impacted. And I believe that local government should have the say where these businesses are located so pedestrians can walk safely without inhibitions. Without the ability to limit adult entertainment venues in the downtown Beaverton area, there's a huge impact that will take place. As I said, I work for IBM, and we recruit employees to Beaverton so they can work, raise their families, and give back to the community. And we look for communities that are safe and healthy and family-oriented for our workforce. Our city needs to limit and manage these types of venues in our downtown area near schools and pedestrian thoroughfares, family shopping and recreation areas. And I recognize that this is only about exotic dancing, but again, the impact to our community will be huge unless we support HJR 56. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Dahl.
Thank you, members of the, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is TJ Sullivan. I'm a city councilor with the City of Salem. I also serve on the board for the Chamber of Commerce here. And the City of Salem strongly supports HB 3547 and HJR 56. This narrowly focused bill will not allow cities to control all aspects of such an establishment, but it will allow cities to determine the extent of a strip act inside the establishment. This is a very important restriction which cities should be in control. Each community will have the ability to interpret such acts and find common sense solutions within their own ordinances. And I guess for me, there are two things I would like to further point out to you. One, I think that this would be a hard thing to go back to your constituents and say that you didn't even support the opportunity for them to have a say on this matter, and that you supported unlimited acts inside these establishments. And I think that it's we've all heard that all politics is local, and I think that this is a good way for you you guys as state legislators to get some of these local city issues off of your plate and back onto the plates of where they should be, I believe, and that's in the hands of the city councils that would be regulating these things. There's nothing more frustrating than in the case of the City of Salem, where we have one of these clubs opening up 507 feet away from a city park, and where state law says 500 feet and the city council is absolutely powerless to address this issue. And you've got constituent after constituent turning out, and we have to sit there and listen to them testify and in the end say, we can do absolutely nothing about this. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for any member of this panel? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for being here to all of you. I am a little concerned because I'm hearing some mixed opinions about what this would do. Apparently, there's an impression that it would allow you to govern where strip clubs are located, but then also, I think it was Mr. Sullivan said, it would allow you to govern what happens inside the strip club. So I would just like a little clarification about your understanding about what this would restrict.
Well, I think that that's something that local communities can look at in terms of the proximity and what goes on inside a club. I think that, you know, my understanding is that this would allow us to limit what goes on inside a club. And I think then city councils could look at it as the proximity relationship to schools or parks or businesses that might serve families and decide in those situations what would go on there might be different than something that might happen in an industrial area.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bonamici, I think that my understanding of this measure is probably a little tighter than the city councilors. I think from our perspective, as you well know, serving the area right adjacent to downtown Beaverton, both new dancing clubs are on Beaverton and Hillsdale Highway, which is one of two major spines through our downtown. One of the measures that failed in recent years would have allowed, for example, one of the statewide measures that failed would have allowed, for example, a city to regulate where these places would go. And I think in terms of many interests the city of Beaverton might have, one of them would be to take these businesses off main drags. One of the two new dancing establishments is literally across the tracks from City Hall. And I think in terms of our downtown revitalization efforts, hearing from business owners and members of the chamber, they would like to see these businesses perhaps be in a less visible space, and we think zoning regulations would allow us to move these off main drags and in a less visible spot.
And follow up?
Go ahead.
And is your understanding that this would cover zoning issues? That you'd, if this passes, then you'd be allowed to rezone? I'm just trying to get a sense of it if it's dealing with where they are or what they're doing.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, my testimony was based on areas where the law is settled by the U.S. Supreme Court, and the case law is Renton versus Playtime Theaters. And in that decision, the Supremes held that the city could regulate them within 1,000 feet. I am not currently aware of any case where the Supreme Court ruled on the internal activities of such establishments.
Thank you.
Questions? Thank you very much. Our next panel will be Julia Allison and Darlene London. Signed up as Ms. Allison first and then Ms. London. So if that works for the two of you, why don't you go ahead?
That's fine. Thank you. Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, I'm testifying in support of these two proposals. My name is Julia Allison, 4915 Nina Avenue, Salem, Oregon, and I'm chairman of the Fayright Neighborhood Association, and in which a strip club has been opened in our neighborhood association and has caused a lot of upset, a lot of fear, a lot of trepidation about their activities and what goes on and what goes outside too. I have been asked by literally hundreds and hundreds of people to speak on their behalf because they feel at the last summer's public hearing at City Hall, they were devastated that city councils had no input into the location of these activities. And as T.J. Sullivan said, we only had the criteria of being 500 feet away. Well, it's a church, park, school, playground, care facility. They're all just within a few feet of this 500 feet boundary. The actual club, there's homes that back up onto it. So although it's on South Commercial, the residences are right behind, right around it. And residents are very, very concerned, not just what might go on, but what is going on right now since they have been opened. I have been witnessing late at night activities down there which are not, they are, I know moral is a personal issue, but people coming out at Presley's and urinating in the driveway, women and men. I've seen a woman come out, speak to a man, him handing over some cash, and in a few minutes she's gone off with four men in a car. And I know you can question all these, but they are evidenced. And with a parking situation, 35 to 40 cars have been towed away when they were asked not to park in front of the immediate care clinic and Jackson Hewitt, and they have broken through the chains. I believe, as well as most other people, that alcohol and sexual arousal don't mix and cause problems for us in the community. The value of the neighborhood real estate is going down. The stores right across the street are really upset because it's dragging them down too. And I'm a very emotional person and I'm trying to stick to the facts, but families are really important in residential neighborhoods. The future of our whole lifestyle in America is dependent upon our young people growing up and living in a decent environment. This is not a decent environment around this area, and we would like them moved. I know you can't do away with strip clubs. We would like them moved either to the desert or out to sea or in an industrial park. And for people, if they really want to go out where they don't bother the community. And that's what's so important. If you have driven by Presley's lately, I had my grandchildren in the car. What does that mean on the sign? It says exotic contortionist, way out, blazing out front. How can you explain that to your children, that the Oregon state legislator, the rules apply, that they can do anything they want? You know, how can you explain that to children that it's right to do this? Now, I know you can't regulate perhaps what goes on, but you can regulate the location, and that's what we're here for today, is to try to give the government, the cities, the rule to be able to do the code so that they will not be in a residential neighborhood. And I've asked all the chairmen of the other neighborhoods, there are 19 in Salem, and they agree. They don't want strip clubs in their neighborhoods milling around with the residents there. They're fearful. People are plain fearful of going out, letting their children out. We have Dairy Queen, Baskin Robbins, Northern Lights, Movie Theater, and so forth right around there where the kids hang out. This is a bad example of what life is going to be. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Ms. Allison, we'll hear from Ms. London first.
All right, thank you.
Give an opportunity.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee meeting members. I thank you for listening to this issue. My name is Darlene London. I reside at 1495 Saginaw South, Salem, 97302. I'm here as a private citizen. I live just outside of the neighborhood association that is affected by this particular club. I belong to a neighborhood association. We border this area. I'm speaking in general now for not just us, but I think every neighborhood in the state of Oregon. the Constitution is there to protect people. That is true, and I value the freedom of expression. I personally question whether nude dancing happens to fall into this, but that's a personal thing. But what the Constitution should do is guarantee that the citizens of communities can protect the atmosphere in those communities. We go to a great deal of trouble to try to keep the communities in the Salem area what we call having high standards of quality of life. I can think of no positive contribution that a nude dancing establishment offers to that. We have in the south of Salem a low crime rate, as most of you know. We would like to keep it that way. At the same time, I sat on a committee that is a group of representatives from each of the neighborhoods, and I can tell you that no one wants this in their back door. There lies the problem. But I do believe that by allowing the city the right to choose where these clubs can locate, that they can be placed in atmospheres that do not have the effect that we are all concerned with. As an example, commercial coming off 5 is our entry into Salem. We already have a sex shop, if you will, up closer to the exit on 5. Now we have this nude establishment on commercial. So as anyone coming into the city drives, these are two of the things they see. I don't think that that's the image we want to project for this area. I believe also that in this case, it's very ironic, they have located directly across the street from Baskin-Robbins. Baskin-Robbins is a family establishment with children of all ages coming there, and that is now what you look across the street and see. At the same time, along this area, we have numerous establishments that employ teenagers. We now have these teenagers working in an environment where when they leave those businesses, when their shifts are done, and I fear for the safety somewhere down the road of both young men and women, because somebody who has been drinking in a bar since 5 o'clock in the afternoon and is coming out of there at 12 o'clock at night and has been watching nude dancing is not someone I want in a car on a street where teenagers are waiting for someone to pick them up or possibly earlier the public transportation. I think that's a serious problem.
Ms. London, I haven't been time-limiting the testimony. We have a long agenda, so if you could kind of come to a conclusion.
Those would be, I'm very much in favor of this. And I think it's ironic that recently the city was able to stop someone from having chickens in their yard because they caused a nuisance, noise, and a possible health hazard. But the city is powerless to prevent this sort of thing.
Yep.
And I would also draw attention to one thing, that the owner of this club refers to it as a gentleman's club. I would indeed not ask that no one allow that courtesy to this establishment. It is not a gentleman's club. Are there any questions?
Are there any questions for either of these witnesses?
Thank you
very much.
Thank you for your time.
Our next panel will be John Kinman and Sharon Bauer.
Mr. Chairman, I have some packets if I'm for the committee.
Would that be fine if you could hand them to the committee assistant here?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is John Kinman. I live in Springfield, Oregon. I'm not here to talk in favor of strip clubs. I do want to make some points about my concern about a constitutional amendment that puts wording in the Constitution that could be used to do other things than control strip clubs in certain cities. I am the president of the American Association for Nude Recreation, or AANR. And I'm also the president of the Willamettans, which is a family nudist park located near Marcola, Oregon. Informational packets and a letter stating our position on these bills have been prepared on my behalf, and I've made copies available for each member of the committee. I request that my testimony and that these packets be made part of the public record. My position as president of the American Association for Nude Recreation is a volunteer one. I'm a retired executive vice president from U.S. Band Corps, back in the days when that company was headquartered in Oregon. I spent my entire 32-year banking career in Oregon. AANR is very concerned about the potential unintended consequences that this constitutional amendment might have upon our membership. I'm not an attorney, and I don't know the legal definition of STRIP Act, performance, patrons, clubs, or business enterprise. I do think I know the definition of nude, but my perception of that word or that state is obviously very different from that of the maker of this bill. The Willamettans is a not-for-profit corporation with a 501c7 status approved by the IRS. We operate our 40-acre club under a special use permit issued by Lane County. We pay room taxes on our rental units. We have a license from OLCC to operate a bar as a private club. In addition to the Willamettans, there are 8 other AANR-affiliated clubs in Oregon. Last Saturday, we sang karaoke. I guess some were performing. We are a club. We are a business enterprise, in a sense. Maybe our members and guests could be considered patrons by some definition. And, of course, some people were nude. I guess we're already in violation of this proposed legislation. It seems ironic to me that this committee is considering restricting our activities or allowing local governments to do so, while the Oregon State Parks Department recognizes family nude recreation as a legitimate recreational alternative. We partner with the state through the Adopt a Park program to maintain a section of Rooster Rock State Park for clothing optional use and hold regular cleanup projects. AANR adopted both Rooster Rock and Collins Beach at Sauvie Island within the Salt Adopt a River program. We value our partnerships and the thought that our Oregon Constitution might be amended to put our right to go nude at these beaches concerns us. It's been said that we are not the targets of this bill. It's aimed at the adult entertainment industry. My legal advisors tell me, however, that with this wording in the state constitution, any government body or agency in this state could, at some point in the future, use these very words to outlaw our legitimate activities, which are now sanctioned by several state agencies and protected by our constitution. I respectfully ask that you vote against these bills.
Thank you, Mr. Kimmon. Ms. Bauer.
Yes. My name is Sharon Bauer, and I've been a member of the Willamettans for 35 years. I am a past president. I've raised my children, 7 of them, and 16 grandchildren and 8 great-grandchildren in the nudist movement. We've never had a child be molested on our grounds or anything like that. It's a family park with swimming pools, tennis courts, shuffleboard courts, a little restaurant, a gift shop. We do these as a family group, bring our children, grandchildren to live with us. I live on the grounds now. I'm a permanent resident there. And this bill could close our park down, and that would leave me out probably, being that I'm retired and live on a very small income, living under a bridge someplace. And it would put also 50-some other people who live there permanently out of a home to live in, or a place to live. And we have 450 members. We're all voting members. And I would like to have you consider to think about the nudist parks that are in Oregon so you don't exclude us from our nude activities that we do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bauer. Are there any questions for these witnesses?
Just
Representative Cameron.
Just a quick comment for Mr. Kenman.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was not, and this bill is not intended to make you be in violation. In fact, if this bill is only a resolution to go to the voters, to allow the voters to vote on this, and then, in fact, if it did pass, you still would not be in violation of anything, because your local Lane County has allowed you to do those types of things and have the ability to continue to do that. So I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you.
May I comment?
Briefly.
We have seen other communities in other states where a local community enacts something to ban the very thing that that we stand for, whether it's a park or whether it's people gathering privately in someone's backyard. My feeling is these words in the Constitution would allow that kind of restriction to be placed by a community.
Thank you, Mr. Kimmon. We'll excuse this panel, and our final panel will be Greg Chemov and Andrea Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. Greg Chemov, appearing today with Ms. Meyer on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union. Please don't pass this measure on. It's not my intent today to advocate for or against strip acts, but to help you keep from missing the lesson that those who fail to learn history are doomed to repeat it. This is a measure, however well-intentioned, drafted by former Representative Mannix. Those of you who may have been watching the 1999 legislative session saw how this body wrestled to take another of Mr. Mannix's proposals apart and submit it to the voters in many, many pieces, because it was a measure that was passed in a size that was simply too big for you folks to submit to the voters for their approval. Unfortunately, this measure is not, as Councillor Sullivan has suggested, narrowly focused. It is extremely broadly focused. And if your goal is to give local governments the authority to permit or prohibit or restrict the location of strip acts, you are going about it the wrong way. You did propose a measure from that 1999 session that would have done just that. It was a very small, I believe it was a single sentence amendment proposed by then Representative Patridge. It was a measure that the voters soundly thumped after it was passed by this body, but that was the kind of small amendment that you, by our Constitution, are permitted to offer the voters. This measure, even if you wanted to restrict strip acts, would be dead on arrival if the voters passed it. This very measure will be argued, the validity of it will be argued in circuit court on May 21st, after which we should have at least from that stage a definitive ruling on whether this is the kind of measure that you can be referring to the voters. If it is your inclination to pass something like this on to the voters rather than a more narrowly focused measure, please wait until after that hearing to find out whether you can be doing so. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chamath. Ms. Meyer.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon, here in opposition to both HJR 56 and the ballot title referral, House Bill 3547. As I've testified a few weeks ago, voters have been asked four times in the last 12 years to amend the free speech provision. Now, I'm looking around, and I'm not sure if any of you were around in the 1999 Legislative Assembly when testimony that you heard today was similar to the testimony back then about why local jurisdictions should have this authority. You referred out at that time what became Measure 87, and as Mr. Chamath has indicated, it was soundly defeated. But that was not the first time that this body referred out an amendment, and that one was allows regulation of location of sexually oriented businesses through zoning. Very similar sentiment, and voters spoke on that. In 1996, it was a referral, and it was Measure 31. Obscenity may receive no greater protection than under federal constitution. In some ways similar to this, because this is trying to link it as well to the federal constitution. As previous folks who have testified have indicated, the language is very broad. In addition to the challenge ACLU is bringing to this, we think the language would allow regulation of just about anything. It restricts performances that are nude or partially nude at a business enterprise that is open to members of the public. With all due respect, we are all sitting here today, if I may be so blunt, partially nude because of the definition of that term in the dictionary that the Oregon Supreme Court would rely on. It is not limited in any particular way. In addition, performance can be a play, it can be a ballet, it can be a recording, it can be a film. And I would suggest that things like Champions on Ice and ice skaters and others who often appear more than partially nude to some when they are performing would be affected, as well as a broad array. This language is not narrowly tailored. Now, with all due respect to the earlier testimony of the mayor, I just want to indicate that the ACLU was part of leading the effort to defeat these previous measures. In addition, joining that effort were people I would not consider part of the smut industry, former Oregon Supreme Court Justice Betty Roberts, librarians from all over the state, artists and authors including Ursula Le Guin. Join the effort, if you look at the ballot voter comments in the voter pamphlet, you will see that they urge that we do not amend our free speech provision. And Oregonians have voted, and as I mentioned a few weeks ago, just recently is the last election. So we urge you not to move forward with this. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chamath and Ms. Meyer, what can be done about, obviously a lot of people are really unhappy, and as Mayor Drake mentioned, there's some strip clubs near my district. There are also some in unincorporated Washington County right across from the boundary, so there's actually more than he mentioned. What can be done with regard to zoning? And also, I noticed in the article about the case that with the Italian name that I Ciccianelli.
Oh, it's a Chunkinelli, but I think that's wrong.
I noticed that the court did uphold a conviction for promoting prostitution. So, what can be done about regulating? For example, could we pass a law that said that somebody can't get paid for sex acts? And would that address the issue of what's happening inside some of the clubs? I'm trying to get a sense of what we can do both in terms of regulating where the clubs are located and what goes on inside of them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I think if I can take your questions in reverse order, it's already against the law to pay someone for a sex act. That is prostitution. If a local government wants to, for example, remove all businesses from a particular area, it's welcome to do that. If it wants to remove all businesses with a certain number of people in them from a particular area, it's welcome to do that. What our Constitution does not permit a local government to do is keep a business away based upon the free speech that's happening inside the business or on the signs outside the business. If you want to deal with the problems that these kind of establishments may bring to an area, then you need to treat them like Salem treats the chickens, which is, if they're a nuisance, get rid of them because they're a nuisance. If a business's patrons are urinating outside, causing problems for the neighbors because they are loud, disruptive, or in any other way consistently obnoxious, a city has the authority to close that business down. It doesn't have the authority to close the business down based upon what's happening in terms of speech inside, but if they're obnoxious outside, it can be closed.
Thank you. Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I would simply add that while it might not be available in every situation, I encourage good neighborhood agreements to work out. It's similar that they do in Portland with any business that may have issues arising because of some of the activities happening outside, whether it's a bar, a pantry, 7-Eleven, or other such establishment. Now, not every business is going to be open to that, but I certainly think encourage, regardless of the content of the speech going inside, that any business that, if it runs to the level as Mr. Chamoff described, then you've got acts that you've got statutes to rely on in terms of punishing them. But if it's just trying to create a good neighborhood environment, then I encourage that outreach to be done, and I think that's been done successfully in a number of places.
Can I ask a follow-up, please? Short on time. House Joint Resolution 56 says it's intended to allow the state or local government to adopt regulatory restrictions for strip acts, as many other states or local governments have done, to the extent allowed under the Constitution of the United States. So does the Constitution of the United States allow a jurisdiction to say you can't be here, but you could, we need to send you out to an industrial park?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. If there are no further questions, then excuse these witnesses and close the public hearing on House Bill 3547 and House Joint Resolution 56. I will now open a work session on House Bill 3547 and House Joint Resolution 56. Committee, this is the last day for us to consider bills that originate here on the House side, so we have to do something with these bills or they die today. There is a subsequent referral to the Rules Committee, so our choices are to move them on to Rules or to let them die here. If they move on to Rules, then maybe some of these same issues will be aired, but I think it's a useful kind of discussion to have presented here. We could move them without recommendation, or we could move them with a due pass recommendation. It does appear to me from the presentation we had that there are some issues in the language that has been proposed. That is, a lot hinges on what a performance is. For example, the nudist establishments, the only thing distinguishing them from the adult entertainment businesses that this is aimed at would seem to be the term performance. There's an issue, I think, probably in what constitutes partial nudity. So there are some issues in the language, and the question is, should we be moving these on to the Rules Committee so that those issues can be considered? Because I think that there's probably work that would need to be done on the language if these were to go forward to the ballot.
Mr. Chair, I'll just make a comment on the May 21st Circuit Court. I think that if we fail to move, it'll be too late. Obviously, the Circuit Court can have their opportunity to look at this and have their opinion on May 21st. I know the ballot title has already been challenged and is pretty solid, so I'd really appreciate if this committee could move this to the if we got to move it to Rules, fine. I'd even like to see it go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We can send it over to the Senate and have it sit over there see what the Senate does with it.
I think enough constitutional questions have been raised for me today that I'm going to be a no vote on this.
I'm going to be a no vote, and I just want to clarify, because especially in light of the comment that was made about what were your constituents say, I don't like these places. I don't like strip clubs. I wish they weren't in my neighborhood, but I think we need to focus on zoning, and I'm really intrigued with the holding in the case about the, using the prostitution laws. If somebody's being paid for a sex act, then let's find out if we can expand those to address the issues. And I also want to note that some of the places, like Mayor Drake said, are going out of business. That would be great if they all did. If they didn't get the customers that they needed, that would be absolutely fine with me. I also want to state that I received a lot of correspondence over the weekend about this from constituents and others who said we like the Constitution just the way it is, and it isn't because they like these clubs. It's just that they're concerned about amending the Constitution.
Representative Wisner.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm prepared to move the bill either to rules or to the floor. I think, as we heard today from the citizens, they think that we're responsible and we should do something. So we have enough lawyers in this building that we could maybe clean it up.
Any further discussion? Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I, too, with questions, this is the first time we're hearing this, and I know I did talk to Representative Cameron briefly this morning, but I would give it an opportunity to move it to rules and let him look at the constitutional issues, but that's just where I am.
Chair Representative Krieger.
Is rules going to continue to hold hearings after today?
They're still open.
On House bills?
Now, whether they're holding hearings on them, I don't know, but they are still open and can consider House bills. So the bill doesn't, it's not subject to the same constraint that we have here, which is that a bill that we don't act on today, the House bill is dead.
I'm sure that's clarified. That's fine. I'm prepared to move the bill down there.
Then I guess the question, if I'm hearing a mix of views about whether or not to move, whether it should move with a recommendation or not, I would have to say in its current condition, I could not support a due pass a recommendation because I think that the language is overly broad. I would support a motion to move it to rules so that it could be worked further to see whether there's something there that could move forward. So I guess the question is there a motion before us that anyone would offer up either with a recommendation or not?
Mr. Chair, I'll move to move HGR 56 and House Bill 3547 to the Rules Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron has moved House Bills 3547 and House Joint Resolution 56 to the Rules Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion of that motion?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be hard-pressed to do a due pass, but I would send it with no recommendation.
I'm going to move an amendment to the motion to move it without recommendation. I think that is where we can get sufficient support in the committee to move the bills. So we have a motion to amend Representative Cameron's motion to move House Bill 3547 and House Joint Resolution 56, but to move it with a without recommendation. Any discussion of that motion to amend?
I want to clarify that the purpose of moving it to rules would be to try to conform it to so it's constitutional.
Right. So it's constitutional and clear enough, I'd say, even beyond the sort of question of whether it would be unconstitutional. I just think that its current form is too broad. I mean, the partial nudity language, for example, you think about what sort of standards are in different cultures. It is deeply offensive to peoples in some culture that women would be unveiled, for example, and so I think that language would need work before this could become I think something that would be an acceptable expression for our Constitution. So we have a motion to amend the motion to move the bill so that it would be on a without recommendation. Is there any further discussion of the motion to amend? Is there any objection to the motion to amend? Representative Wisner objects. So let's take a roll call vote on the motion to amend the main motion so that it would make it a without recommendation recommendation to the Rules Committee. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
No.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. The motion carries, so the motion to move the bill to rules is amended so that it will be without recommendation. Any further discussion of that amended motion? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will support the motion to move it to rules for further consideration and perhaps some clarification of the language. I find it a bit of a stretch that in our culture we would even bring up the context of that we would consider being behind veils or that ice skating outfits would be considered within the definition. However, in order to address those concerns, let's move it forward and see what we can do.
Mr. Chair, one time during my past life, we would bring the police union would bring a circus show into town at Christmas time, and they'd be circus acts, families, fathers, daughters, sons, and some people came up and complained that they thought the outfits were far too skimpy, that they were partially nude and so on. So these kind of things are can easily go overboard, and that's what is the real problem for me in voting for this, or why I'm going to vote no.
And I just want to add, Mr. Chair, that I've seen some theater productions that could very well be, at legitimate theaters, that could very well fall within this, so concerns about the breadth.
Okay, we have, is there any further discussion of the main motion then?
Just Mr. Chair, if there's a city in the state that wants to eliminate circus acts because of this bill, then maybe we should live in a different city. But I will support the motion, and hopefully we will not let this bill die in a committee because this is important for the people.
Any further discussion? Then we have a motion before us to move House Bill 3547, House Joint Resolution 56, to the Committee on Rules by prior reference and without recommendation as to its ultimate passage. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Yes.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kopp.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
No.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. Motion carries, and House Bill 3547 and House Joint Resolution 56 moved to the Committee on Rules. Close the work session on those two measures. For the benefit of those who are in the audience, we have only one other public hearing that had been set for today, which was on House Bill 2890. That is being pulled from the agenda. House Bill 2890 will not be heard today, nor will it go to work session. We have the rest of our agenda is a long series of work sessions on bills that will mainly seem familiar to your committee, and we'll intend to take them in roughly the order in which they're printed here on the agenda. I will now open a work session on House Bill 2909. Council Kalmanson, would you remind us where we stand on this bill?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2909, I'm sure this committee is well familiar with, changes the statutes of ultimate repose in products liability actions. There are a number of different amendments and different options for the committee to consider. The Dash 2 amendments would increase the statute of repose by 4 years. The Dash 3 amendments are... it's a sort of a different animal that would clarify that the statute of limitations and repose for construction projects, not product liability actions, applies to manufactured dwellings and prefabricated structures. So to simplify things, I would just not consider the Dash 3s right now until we get to some of the bigger issues, which is the what to do with the main statute of ultimate repose. So the Dash 2s would increase it by 4 years. The Dash 5 amendments would create a useful safe life standard, which would mean that the statute of ultimate repose would be the length of the useful safe life of the product. After 10 years, the plaintiff, it would be rebuttably presumed that the useful safe life of the product is 10 years, and the plaintiff would have the burden of overcoming that presumption by preponderance of the evidence. There are also certain exceptions in the Dash 5 amendments where there would be no statute of repose, and that would be if there's a warrant that the product is going to last longer than the useful safe life, or if there's some intentional conduct, or if there's some exposure to some product within the useful safe life of the product and the injury doesn't manifest itself till after the useless safe life is over. But the main thing to remember about the Dash 5s is that it's a pure useful safe life standard. The Dash 7 amendments would maintain the current 10-year statute of repose for the first 10 years. Then you would have the rebuttal presumption from years 10 to 20, and then there would be a cap at the end of 20 years. So the main difference between the 5s and the 7s is the cap at 20 years. And I'll add that there are also Dash 8s, which are the same as the Dash 7s. I just cleaned up the language in there a little bit to address some of the concerns we heard at the last hearing. And then I was just handed Dash 10s. And if I understand them, and please correct me, whoever they came from, they would increase the statute of repose by 4 years, but would have no statute of repose apply to actions concerning R-type metal halide or mercury vapor light bulb actions. Is that correct? I'm not sure who these... That's right. So it would carve out, for those types of products, any statute of repose.
Specifically, this was the teachers at Lighthouse Weekly.
Right. Yeah, so it would address the lawsuits of the teachers that we heard at the initial public hearing. So those are the different policy choices.
Very good. Committee, this bill has been before us here recently in work session and some time ago in public hearing. Any comments on where we are on this bill? Representative Compton and then Representative Wisniewski.
Thank you. Council, was I spacing in writing? Did you mention the Dash 9s?
I did not. The Dash 9s, a question had come up about the useful safe life standard, about whether it could be used to shorten the current statute of repose or not. Because right now it's 10 years. It's really 8 years, but it's sort of confusing the way it's
right.
Drafted. So what the Dash 9s would do is say that you could argue that the useful safe life is less than 10 years.
Okay,
the Dash 8s would say you couldn't do that.
Okay,
that's
you.
The difference.
I'm sorry, could you just repeat that last
sure.
Time?
The Dash 9, you could argue that, say, a pharmaceutical product had a useful safe life of 2 years.
Right.
In the Dash 8s, you couldn't make that argument. It would be automatic. It would be at least 10 years. So that's the difference between the 8s and the 9s.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we're trying to reach as much agreement as you've talked about as we can on these things. And I think last week we were close to between 2 and 2 and 8 or 2 and
5.
Between 2 and 5, I think. And I think this is an effort to even try to be better compromise and better sausage if we're going to produce. It includes the testimony of those people from Lake Oswego School that their eyes were damaged. They testified about the damage to their eyes from the lights in the gym. That this allows them to also be carved out, which I think we all sort of hate to do, but we understand, and I would support the Dash 10.
Mr. Chair. I also was pretty moved by the testimony of the teachers and believe that they had a very compelling story to tell. And I think that their situation would be covered by what I see as the best amendment here, which is the Dash 5, because there's a rebuttable presumption to get around. There's a 10-year, but then there's that ability to argue around that. And so I think that puts us in line with Washington. And it's more, to me, realistic with how long, taking into account what type of product it is. So I would support the Dash 5 amendments, and if it's appropriate, I'd like to make a motion that we adopt the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2909.
Representative Bonamici moves the Dash 5 amendments to House Bill 2909.
Mr. Chair,
discussion of that motion. Representative
Thank you. Mr. Chair and committee members, we talked about this last year. The liability you can't look at just with this bill. You've got to look at the tort liability reform in Washington or limitations in Washington versus Oregon if you're trying to help the economy and protect the citizens, too.
Further discussion?
I just, Mr. Chair, want to make the point that the most many states don't even have a statute of ultimate repose, and there are still statutes of limitations, and there are still defenses that a manufacturer can assert in this type of case. So,
it's in Krieger. Whenever you get, Mr. Chair, the information that I want, what is the difference on the caps that these states have on liability? How far can it go? Sure, you can have no statute of repose. If you've got a cap in there, it gives some protection. I don't believe we have that. So we're opening up Oregon businesses, I think, to for any business to pretty high risk.
That has been, I'd say, the most prominent argument we've heard against extending the statute of repose on product liability in Oregon. And my view is that you have to look at each one of these separately, because the people who are injured by a product after 8 or 10 years, our current statute of repose, they aren't the same people who are going to have a punitive damage remedy or other remedies, because we have other elements in our liability system that maybe favor other parties. We have to look, I think, at each issue by issue, and see what is the right solution for product liability. That's why I find it persuasive that we should be extending our statute of repose in Oregon, even though we may have other elements of liability that are maybe more favorable to a plaintiff than some other states have.
And I just wanted to point out that the longer the time period goes by, the harder it is to prove a case. So somebody has to have a really good case if it's been a while. So they're still going to have to prove their case. Just as the defense will assert their defenses, the plaintiff is going to have a case to prove, and they're going to have to do that before they can recover. We've also, over the years, carved out so many exceptions, asbestos, breast implants, the side saddle fuel tanks.
Different issue.
It's a reason for changing the statute.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chair and fellow committee members, this has been a hard struggle for me. I still believe that I'm in the middle. I'm a moderate. I would prefer going with the new -10s. I would go with the -8s to put some kind of boundaries on this. I'm really struggling to be able to support the -5s.
Mr. Chair, a couple of questions. I know we're about a motion on the -5s. Maybe if we could have counsel clarify, I'm not clear, what's the difference between the -2s and the -10s that Representative Kopp just referred to? And then the second question is the -3s on the manufactured homes that's not included in the motion. And would that be?
It would be my intention to invite a motion on the -3s after we get figure out where we are in the main issues, and to go back and because I think regardless of what we do, we need to make sure that the manufactured housing and prefabricated structures aren't affected by this change.
So maybe clarification between the 2s and the 10s.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Cameron.
Any amendments?
The difference between the 2s and 10s, I was just handed the -10s, but my understanding is it just carves out, it increases it by four years, and then carves out from any statute of repose the metal halide lamp victims. So causes of action based on the lamps, R-type metal halide or mercury vapor light bulbs, they would have no statute of repose. Otherwise, but the extension to the main product liability statute is the same. It'd be 4 years.
So that's what would help the teachers that we had before us
right.
In the original hearing. Okay, that's
and
great.
Representative Kopp mentioned the -8s, and I'm still struggling with the difference between the -8s and the -9s.
Sure. The -8 amendments are essentially the -7s, but cleaned up a little bit. There was some testimony that in the original draft of the -7s, it said the useful safe life of a product is 10 years. And there was some testimony that could have some unintended consequences. So what the -8s do is try to just change the language around so it gets to the point that for the first 10 years of a product's life, the statute of repose lasts at least that long. You can't make the argument that the useful safe life of a pharmaceutical product is 2 years. In the dash nines, you could make that argument. It would just be a strict useful safe life standard for the first 10 years. So that's the primary difference. And I should also point out that the dash fives have exceptions to the useful safe life rule that the neither the eights nor the nines have those exceptions.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
I think it's interesting the dash three was brought up because, you know, here, and I would probably support the dash three, but here we're talking about, you know, reducing the liability. I was talking to my neighbor this weekend who's a builder, and he was saying, oh, good. But, you know, we had 10 years for all buildings, and now we're going to break that out in dash three. So we're helping this economy, but, you know, we should be looking at the entire economy of Oregon, I think.
There is a separate bill.
Yeah. There's a separate bill on large construction projects that we're going to be taking up in work session here a couple items further on. But the effect of the dash threes is to keep prefabricated structures and manufactured housing at a 10-year statute. It's unclear really whether they're a product or whether they're construction. It wasn't an important distinction in the past because there was a 10-year statute of repose on construction and an 8 or 10 years, depending on how you calculate it, for products. So it's about the same. But when we start changing the statute of repose significantly for product manufactured, product liability, it becomes important then which line side of that line it falls on. And the purpose of the dash threes is to make it clear that that type of construction would be treated as construction and subject to, you know, maintenance kinds of analysis rather than under a strict product liability analysis.
Mr. Chair, you've got a motion on the table, which I don't support. I'd prefer the dash 10s, so it kind of helps, I think, you and the rest of the committee to understand kind of where everybody is. If you vote for the fives and it doesn't pass, we can come back to the 10s, and at some point we're going to have to make that vote.
Right, if you're getting a sense here now about where committees are.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Thank you. I made a note on my dash fives that on April 26th, which was just last week, there was lack of support for that. And perhaps at that point in our discussion, that may have been the case. I would prefer to support the dash tens, which increases the statute of ultimate repose by 4 years from 10 to 14 years and provides for the Khalid-like injuries.
I think what's happening, committee, is that thinking this is a difficult set of issues, and that further meeting time has allowed people to kind of focus and refine their thinking on it. But we are now down to the last day of our action on House bills, so that we don't have time, the luxury of setting it over for another day to make other decisions.
I just want to make a point on that. The way I read the dash fives, there's a rebuttable presumption of 10 years, but it can be rebutted. And so the useful safe life could be even less than 10 years. It seems like a very reasonable approach to me.
Mr. Chair, once again, I think that 20-year period, which the dash fives are based on, the Washington model, they also have a significant punitive damage law that. So I think that there's some offset in that whole discussion. Oregon is not the same as Washington.
Representative Comp, did you have a motion?
There was
a motion to amend that thought was.
Yes, well, I was going to say, and I don't know how to do that, but I would make a motion to amend the motion for the dash fives and insert the dash eights.
Yeah, we have a motion now to substitute for the dash fives in the motion before us, the dash eight amendments. Those are the ones that take us to basically a cleaned up version of what was formerly the dash sevens. That is, that it's no statute of repose for the first 10 years, and then a rebuttable presumption after 10 years up until 20 years, and then at 20 years, then a final ultimate repose at 20 years.
Mr. Chair, I'd like a copy. I don't have a copy.
The difference between the dash 5s and the dash 8s.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Bonamici. So the dash 5s are a pure, useful, safe life standard. So it is the statute of repose goes for as long as the useful safe life of the product. There is a rebuttable presumption after 10 years that the useful safe life is over, and the plaintiff can rebut that by a preponderance of the evidence. The dash 5s also contain three exceptions to the useful safe life standard. One of them has to do with if the manufacturer warrants that the product is going to last longer than what someone ultimately determines is the useful safe life, that would be an exception. Another exception is for an intentional misrepresentation about the product. And the third exception has to do with if you are exposed to the product during the useful safe life, but the injury manifests itself after the useful safe life. So those are the dash 5s, and there's no cutoff. The dash 8s have a 20-year cutoff. What the dash 8s would do is say, at a minimum, the ultimate statute of repose is 10 years. So even if you can't argue that it's 2 years or 3 years, it would be at least 10. Then there would be a rebuttable presumption that the plaintiff would rebut by preponderance of the evidence that the useful safe life of the product is over after 10 years. So the plaintiff could come forward with evidence and say it's 14 years, but they would have the burden of proving that. There would be a cap at 20 years. It would be, you'd be out of luck, and there would be no exceptions. So the main difference is it takes out the exceptions, it puts in a cap, and you can't argue that the useful safe life is less than 10 years.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Krieger.
Counsel, aren't there many products out there that are designed not to last 10 years? In our mind, they wouldn't. Now we're saying that they have to?
I'm sure there are products that are designed not to last 10 years. But this is just a statute of ultimate repose, so you could still prove that all this would say is you're not automatically cut off from coming to court. You could still have all the other defenses you might otherwise have.
No, and I don't actually have the dash 8s in my bill file. Do other people have the dash 8s?
Yes.
I'm
on the desk.
Okay. I got a
whole
bunch. Eight.
Sure, I think we should vote on the motion on the floor.
Okay. We have a motion before us to amend the main motion to replace the dash 8s instead of the dash, replace in the motion the dash 8s for the dash 5s. That's the motion that's before us. Is there any further discussion of that? If not, the clerk will call the roll on that motion to substitute the dash 8s into the motion on the bill.
No.
No.
Representative
Flores.
No.
Representative Clark.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
No.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
No.
Chairman Person.
Aye. Motion fails, so we still have the main motion before us, which is the dash 5 amendments. Then any further discussion of the motion on the dash 5s?
Mr. Chair, I will not be supporting the dash 5.
Okay. Then the clerk call the roll on the motion, main motion, which is to amend House Bill 2909 with the dash 5s.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative Pomp.
No.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett. No.
Chairman Person.
Aye. That motion fails. So we're having trouble kind of finding our consensus point here, committee.
Mr. Chair, I move dash 10.
The Representative Wisnett moves the dash 10 amendments into House Bill 2909. Is there any discussion of that motion?
Yes, thank you. I was just wondering if there's any useful safe life version that we could all agree on, because it seems to make more sense to me than a safe one.
Well, evidently not.
Well, you haven't voted on the dash 9s. And that has a useful safe life, but you could argue that it was less than 10 years.
It's the excuse me, Representative, did Representative Wisnant move the dash 10s? So that's the motion before
us.
It is pending.
The motion before us is to move the dash 10 amendments into House Bill 2909. I can't support the dash 10s because I think it does address the most dramatic case that was before us, which is the instance of the defective light bulbs. But that put into focus the issue that was before us of the what could happen to anybody who's harmed by a product. I mean, it's helpful to have it put into focus, but it leaves then to the next time somebody is injured by a product in Oregon, they will, if it happens not to be a defective light bulb, they will be out of court after the 10-year statute of repose runs.
14.
It's just another product-specific carve-out.
Fine, we could move the dash 2s.
Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, just in terms of the sequence in which we've been taking these, then I think it might make sense to look at the 9s first. So I would move to amend the 9s for the motion on the floor.
A motion to move amendments can be amended to substitute another set of amendments. That can be done.
Chair, since council brought this one as an option up, could you explain it a little more in depth so we have a better understanding?
Sure. Thank you, Representative Comp. The dash 9 amendments, the main difference between the dash 9s and the dash 8s it's a useful safe life standard where you can argue that the product had a useful safe life of less than 10 years, which is something you couldn't do with the dash 8s. From 10 years to 20, it would be a rebuttable presumption that the useful safe life of the product is ended. So the plaintiff would have to prove that it's more than 10 years. At 20 years, it's over. That's the cap, and there's no exceptions.
Thank you for the additional information. That helps.
You're welcome.
Just one more point I wanted to make. One of the reasons I didn't like the dash 8s was because the automatic 10-year, and I think that there are products that are the useful safe life is less than 10 years, so that was my concern with the dash 8.
Let me understand the difference. Maybe I'm confused here. The dash 8s, difference between the dash 8s and the dash 9s. Council, could you refresh?
Thank you, Chair McPherson. The primary difference between the dash 8s, in fact, the only difference between the dash 8s and dash 9s, are whether you can argue that a product has a useful safe life of less than 10 years. Dash 8s you could, the dash 8s you could not, the dash 9s you could.
So it would meet your concerns, Representative right. Bonamici, if you adopt that, you go to the dash 9s rather than the dash 8s.
Right. I was concerned with the dash 8s that you couldn't argue that a product's useful safe life was less than 10 years. I don't think that's reasonable.
Right. And I missed that point.
I think that you should be able to argue if the useful safe life is less than 10 years, and that's what the dash 9s do.
Correct.
Okay. I'm wondering if the dash 9s are emerging as where we might have a bare consensus, a bare majority on this bill, rather than I thought maybe it might come around the dash 8s, but it's the dash 9s.
I had it reversed.
Okay. Well, we have a motion before us, which is to move the dash 10s. Into House Bill 2909.
Mr. Chair, I move to substitute the 9s.
I beg your pardon. Representative Reed has moved to substitute the dash 9 amendments for dash 10 amendments in the motion before us. Is there any further discussion of that motion? Then, if not, let's have a roll call vote on the substituting the dash 9s for the dash 10s in the main motion.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative Kopp.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
No.
Vice Chair Wisnant.
No.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. That motion fails, so we have the dash 10 motion to move the dash 10s before us. Any further discussion? Then the clerk will call.
This bill is obviously, as we used to say, is screwed up as Hogan's goat, and it's late in the day, and I'll be willing to give a courtesy vote to move it, but boy, what a mess. I mean, we're jumping.
Well, I would say the closest we have to a consensus representative is the dash nines.
We don't know what the vote on 10 is, Mr. Chair.
Well, let's take a vote on the dash 10s then. Let's call a roll call on the dash 10s.
Representative Amici.
No.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Kopp.
No.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
No.
Vice Chair Barker.
No.
Vice Chair Resnick.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
No. So that motion fails. So we're kind of between the nines and the tens, and so I would say the dash nines are where I think the closest we have to a consensus within the committee.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash nine amendments to House Bill 2909.
Just voted on that, Mr. Chair.
No, we didn't. No. We voted to
substitute.
No. We didn't vote on the amendments.
Any further discussion of the motion to move the dash nines?
Mr. Chair, I'm totally disappointed in this, and I think this is not the way good legislation.
Well, I would say, Representative, we are of various minds on this bill, and that is what it comes down to, decision point. You have different points of view, and you try to sort out where the common ground is, and that's what we do in this building. Any further discussion on moving the dash nines?
I have one comment. The last time we left this last week, the dash twos movement was left, or it was a motion was left on the table, and we didn't vote on it. I believe you made it, Representative Winsett, and we closed the hearing without even having a vote on it. So it would have been nice to have voted on it. We had the votes that particular day to do it.
Committee members, I apologize if we had a motion that I did not listen
to. You can check the tape.
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to debate the process that this committee is going about this, but I just want to make another statement. I have in front of me that we rank 30 in state liability systems ranking in the United States, and even the adoption of the dash 10s would have taken us even lower on that ranking, and now we're going to adapt something even more that's going to take us even lower. And I believe the constituents that I represent, the citizens, are looking for good jobs, good businesses to come to this state, and we need to be very careful in all the things we do. This is one little thing that's going to add to businesses having a more difficult time to expand in the state of Oregon, which creates great jobs, which keeps people in payroll, which keeps them educated, which keeps them off the streets.
Okay. Further discussion of the motion before us, which is to move the dash nine amendments. If not, the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
Excused.
Representative Kopp.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Resnick.
I refuse to vote tonight.
That took us down a road the other day. I'm not sure we want to go back down, Representative.
A strong no and disappointment, Mr. Chair.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. So the House, dash 9 amendments are in the bill. We need a motion on the dash 3 amendments because we have now extended the statute of repose the amended version of the bill so that it would could adversely affect manufactured housing and prefabricated structures, and so I would invite a motion on the dash threes.
Mr. Chair, I move that we amend 2909 with the dash threes also.
Representative Kopp moves the dash three amendments in the House Bill 2909. Any discussion of that motion? Any objection to the dash three amendments? Then the dash three amendments are in the bill. So we now have the bill as amended by the dash three and dash nine amendments. Committee, one of the issues for us is that we have to act on this bill today or it dies. There, as we saw in the last bill that we considered, we do have the Rules Committee that's still open. So if there's concern about about where this, how this bill stands, and that it needs further work. And there's a big concern about a somewhat ragged process here. And I apologize if there was a motion before in a prior meeting. I wasn't aware of that. It wasn't called to my attention that I'd left a motion die, and certainly tried not to do that. Try to make sure we have an orderly process. One way to address these issues would be to move this bill to the Rules Committee instead of out to the floor if people are not comfortable with the condition that it's in at this point. So that would be a possibility, would be to move it to Rules rather than to move it directly to the floor. Representative Bonamici.
Well, I just wanted to make a point as I'm sitting here reading the Dash 9 amendments, which, of course, we haven't all had time to study, that they do provide that... unless a manufacturer, distributor, seller, or lessor has warranted a product for a longer period of time, more than 10 years after the commencement of the useful safe life of the product is rebuttably presumed to have been caused after the useful safe life. So there's a 10-year rebuttable presumption in there, and that, I think, gives a lot of protection. The plaintiff's going to have to rebut if it's after 10 years, and that's going to be a tough burden, and they're going to have to prove that if an injury is caused after 10 years. So I think there's protection in the Dash 9s, and I'd prefer to move it with the due pass recommendation as amended.
Mr. Chair, it's clearly this isn't an up or down here. I mean, it's a lot of things. I would like to move it to Rules. I would suggest we move it to Rules so they can take another look at it. It's just when you get 10 amendments, there's some deep problems in the bill, or potential deep problems, and I think Rules could straighten that out, get it sorted out a little better before it comes to the floor.
Representative Kump.
I don't disagree with that, but my only question, and I don't know how things process through Rules. Is it sending it to, will it die there? But I don't know.
It could or could not. That's the Rules Committee. This session is going to be the end game, sort of the end game committee. Things go there, some will come out, some won't.
Okay, thank you. In other words, we can't predict.
Yeah. Right, yeah. I think all we can say is that it is out of our hands, and obviously it's been a difficult process in our hands.
And one more comment. I just want to remind everyone that there's still a statute of limitations. A product liability action must be commenced not later than 2 years after the date on which the plaintiff first discovered or should have discovered the injury, death, or damage. There's still a statute of limitations. This is for those cases where, and they're few, where there's a time limit. And we heard the testimony. Some injustices. People don't get their day in court. And I think this is a good bill, and let's just send it to the floor and see how it goes.
Well, we don't have a motion before us at this point. We have a bill that's amended by the Dash 9s and Dash 3s.
Yes. Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2909 is amended with the Dash 3 and the Dash 9 amendments to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2909 is amended by the Dash 3s and the Dash 9s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion of that motion?
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to make a comment. Oregon ranks 30th in 50 states on overall state liability systems. Passing this bill is going to make it even harder for people to find good jobs in the state of Oregon.
Any further discussion? Then the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative
Flores. Excused.
Representative Scott.
No.
Representative
Krieger. No.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
I'll give a courtesy aye.
Oh, okay.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
No.
Chair
Representative
Person.
Comp, would you like to change your vote? I heard an expression from you.
Well, I would have... I'll leave my vote as it is because I like the idea of sending it to Rules.
Okay, very good. Then motion fails. Do I hear a motion to send the bill to Rules?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2909 as amended to Rules.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2909 as amended by the Dash 3 and Dash 9 amendments to the Rules Committee. Is that with a due pass recommendation?
Yeah.
Okay, with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion of that motion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
Excused.
Representative Cobb.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
No.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2909, as amended by the dash threes and dash nines, is moved with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Rules. Thank you, committee members, for that, what has been a difficult kind of consideration of the issues in the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I think that this has been long and drawn out. We know who the special interest groups on this issue are, and I hope we made the right decision for the people of Oregon, which I think is who we're here to serve. I explained to the chair that I plan to ask for a minority report, but since you've referred it to rules, that's not possible. So. I'm terribly disappointed.
Okay. I close the work session on House Bill 2909 and open a work session on House Bill 3129.
Mr. Chair, back to you.
Yeah, please.
Committee members, for the record, Jeff Barker, House District 28, Representative House District 28. This bill was a simple bill. In that when Multnomah County a few years ago passed the income tax, federal and state retirement employees who were on PERS under the PERS system or federal system were exempt from paying that tax. However, the retired Portland police and firefighters were not due to an oversight. This bill just includes Portland police and firefighters who are in their own pension system, those from the beginning until this year, new hires are going into officer. And what this would do is just put them on the same footing with all the other retirees. And part of the requirements in the state for not being in PERS, you have to be equal to or better than. This just makes them equal. There's a little bit of language problem. What I'd ask is if we pass this out today, go ahead and pass it on the floor, and they can correct that on the other side. Just the city's asked for a little clarification, but are fine with it going out as is.
And Representative Barker, we have dash one amendments here from, I think, when we considered this originally. There are dash twos that are.
Yeah, there's the dash twos.
I do have them.
I think we go with the dash twos, and then the cities wanted a little bit of clarification about a word pensions in there, and they can do that on the other side so that we don't delay it today here.
Okay, any questions of Representative Barker? Okay, thank you, Representative. This bill, committee members, has a came to us with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Its impacts, though, it strikes me, are to revenue, particularly local government revenue, rather than to the state general fund budget.
Absolutely.
So it seems like a subsequent to revenue would be more appropriate than a subsequent to Ways and Means. And so what I think would invite is a motion to, after we adopt the dash two amendments, would be to move it to request a rescission of the referral to Ways and Means and a referral instead to revenue. Okay.
Representative Barker. The dash twos.
Representative Barker moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 3129. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Then the dash two amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3129 as amended to rule, rescind the order to Ways and Means and send it to Rules, since that seems to be
to revenue.
I'm sorry, to revenue.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Representative Barker moves the House Bill 3129 as amended with a due pass recommendation, requesting rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means and substituting for it a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue. Is there any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Excused.
Representative Cobb.
Aye.
Excused.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye, and I would like to note the potential conflict in that I'm a member of that group.
So noted for the record.
Vice
Chair
Lizette.
Yay.
Chairman Person.
Aye. House Bill 3129 as amended moves to the Committee on Revenue, subject to the approval from the Speaker's office to replace the prior reference to referral to Ways and Means with one to Revenue. Close the work session, House Bill 3129.
Mr. Chair, can I ask that you reopen 2909 for just a brief statement?
Okay, I will reopen the work session of House Bill 2909.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to express a concern that I had about a comment that was made about how a vote on this bill might be because of some special interest and how we really need to act in the interest of the people of Oregon. And what I thought about when I made my vote was the teachers from Lake Oswego, Mrs. Kirkwood, who was hurt in the truck, and that's who I had in mind as the people, not any special interest. So I just wanted to make that clear. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Thank you. I'll reclose the work session of House Bill 2909 and open a work session on House Bill 3241. Representative Krieger, we just held a work session on House Bill 3129. Did you want to cast a vote on that? I'll move a suspension of the rules to permit to reopen the work session on House Bill 3129 and permit Representative Krieger to vote on House Bill 3129. Is there any objection to that motion? If not, we've suspended the rules, reopened the work session, and Representative Krieger, how do you vote?
Thank you.
He votes aye. Reclose the work session of House Bill 3129, and we are now in work session on House Bill 3241. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3241 is another statutory repose bill. What it would do is decrease the statutory repose for large commercial structures to 6 years. It's currently 10 years. They would make it 6.
So, committee members, this is going the opposite direction from the bill that we had on product liability, and it is limited to large commercial structures so that it leaves at 10 years the statute of repose for small commercial structures or residential structures, but then large commercial structures would have a shortened statute of repose.
No amendments on this one, Mr. Chair?
There are no amendments. On this bill.
What a relief.
None that I'm aware of. Are we in work session?
We are in work session.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3241 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3241 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion of that motion?
Mr. Chair, this bill would help Oregon's rankings go from 30th, maybe a little bit higher.
Committee members, this is a scaled-down version of a bill that came through the Judiciary Committee in the last session, and it's a much better bill than the one we considered at that point, in my view, because that would have shortened the statute of repose on all construction to 6 years. Nevertheless, I just think that cutting off people's remedies arbitrarily based on the passage of time is not good public policy until a sufficient amount of time has passed. So I do not support this bill, but I think it's an important policy choice, and I wanted to make sure that it got out before the committee. So I will not support the motion, but I do think it's, an important policy choice for our committee to consider. One variation on the motion that one might consider would be whether it is so much of a part with the policy choices reflected in 2909 that the Committee on Rules ought to consider this one along with it. So I just throw that out as a possible approach you could take with this bill. Any further discussion?
We have a motion.
We have a motion before us, which is to move House Bill 3241 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I have just a quick question for counsel. If, say, for example, somebody's in a hotel 6 years and one day after the hotel is built and the floor collapses and they're seriously injured, do they have a claim?
If the hotel is considered, I thank you, Representative Bonamici, if the hotel fits within the definition of large commercial structure,
and it's 6 years after substantial completion of that structure, and it fits within the type of action fits within sub one, which it sounds like it would, then yes, they would be without a claim. So it would have to fit within the definition of a large commercial structure. It would have to fit within the definition of a large commercial structure, and the claim that you were bringing would have to be within types of claims that they're cutting off. And if those two conditions are satisfied, then yes, they would not have a claim.
They wouldn't have a claim against the contractor, but they may have a claim against the owner of the hotel.
Yeah, for maintenance or anything else.
Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Thank you.
That was my question.
Right. Yeah, it specifies in sub 1 of 12.135 an action against a person arising from such person having to perform the construction, alteration, or repair of an improvement, or having furnished the design, planning, surveying, architectural, or engineering services for the improvement. So it would only be construction defect type cases.
One more question. Sorry.
It's okay.
So if there's a repair, does this period of time run from the time of the repair?
Representative Bonamici, yes, it would be 6 years after substantial completion. If the cause of action arises out of that repair, it would be 6 years from substantial completion of the repair.
Thank you.
If it's a large commercial structure.
We have a motion before us, which is to move the bill due pass to the floor. I had offered this the suggestion that, in fact, I'm going to put this into a the form of an amendment to the main motion, which is to move the bill to the Committee on Rules instead of directly to the floor. Do pass, but with to the Committee on Rules. Is there any discussion of that motion to amend? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I did hear the last portion of your comment because you felt it held closely to the prior bill, or 2909, and having to do with statute of limitations or ultimate repose. But if there seems to be support for the bill, I'm unclear as to why we would put it into rules and not move it directly to the floor.
Because my view of it, Representative, is that the question of what our repose period should be for these are different areas of commercial activity, but they do kind of butt up against each other, and that the policy choices that are reflected in the product liability statute of repose then also reverberate through the issue of statute of repose on commercial structures. So I think that they should go the same place, because I think that they raise many of the same, they raise parallel and interrelated issues.
Mr. Chair, I believe there's the votes to move it as the motion was, and the fact that this committee has had jurisdiction over this, has had the testimony several times, to send it somewhere else with people that haven't heard any of the discussion, it may die there. I will not vote for your, whatever you've done there, amended the motion.
It was in a motion to an amendment to the motion, which is to substitute the Committee on Rules for the reporting to the floor.
I'll return when we get back to the chair of the committee, in respect for everybody in the audience and the members that you have on your committee.
We have a motion on an amendment to the motion to refer the committee to the Committee on Rules. Is there discussion of that motion? Then the clerk will call the roll on that motion.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Tamlin.
No.
Representative Flores.
No.
Representative Kahn.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Excused.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
No.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
No.
Chairman Wilson? Aye. Motion fails. So we have before us the main motion, which is to move the bill with a due pass recommendation to the floor. There's House Bill 3241 with the due pass recommendation to the floor. Any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici?
No.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Kopp?
No.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
No.
Cliff, would you summarize the what the vote tally was on that?
Five ayes, three nays.
The motion carries. House Bill 3241 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on House Bill 3241.
Hearing? Not even nice.
Representative Cameron, you have spoken very passionately on this issue, and I would ask that you carry the bill.
Okay.
Unless you prefer that we ask Representative Krieger.
Either way, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
Let's get our business done.
Okay. We now move on to a totally unrelated subject matter. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3279.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3279 concerned the free speech rights of student journalists in high schools and colleges. There are a whole lot of amendments which I haven't seen before. I think they mostly relate to the damages provision. What I think is probably best is for whoever's amendments these are to summarize what they do. I think the dash twos the dash fours allow amend the civil action provisions to allow an action for damages and also an award of $100 in nominal damages. They also, I believe, delete that section of the bill which says that the statements of a student journalist is not the policy of the school. And so those are the dash fours. But I think, to be honest, I'm not even sure who's proposing these and which version they want forward. So I think what's best is whoever they are could tell us what it is they would like.
We have Representative Galizio, chief sponsor of the bill, in the room. And we could maybe bring the school folks up as well, so we can lay the policy issues out here.
Mr. Chair, go ahead.
Representative Galizio.
For the record, Larry Galizio, State Representative of House District 35. I know this committee has been working extraordinarily hard, so I appreciate that. I think this one's going to be a lot simpler. A lot simpler than some of the bills that you've had up. It's my understanding, and Representative Bonamici is going to be helpful here because she worked on the amendment process, that the dash four amendment kind of supersedes everything and really takes care of that which was in the other amendments. So. I can explain some, and then we folks from the school board can also explain. And I think the good news is, if you recall, it was probably quite some time ago, we had a little bit of a disagreement over the bill, and I think we've reached compromise, which is very good. So I would look at the dash four amendments, which is the one that we have support on. And I could just walk you through that.
Please do.
With the help of Representative Bonamici,
when
too.
When you say support, that is consensus on the dashboard?
Well, I should say consensus. I'll let the school board folks speak for that. But. So, in the first, on page one, we're just deleting lines 9 and 10 just to prevent any confusion about whether we're talking about the Oregon court decisions or national court decisions. It's just a whereas clause, not very important. On page 2, line 7, the school boards wanted us to delete the word advertising so students wouldn't have editorial control over advertising content, and I agreed to that compromise. I thought that was a legitimate compromise considering the concerns there. Now, on the next section where we delete 23 through 32, dealing with the legal remedy, and I'd like to, Mr. Chair, if I may, turn it over to Representative Bonamici to explain the logic, as she has a JD and I do not, and she can do a better explanation of this.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Representative Galizio. And Mr. Chair, the purpose for deleting paragraphs 5 and 6 on page 2, which is lines 23 through 32, was to take out two things, the immunity provision and the attorney's fees provision. The immunity provision that was in this bill changed current law. Taking it out preserves current law. Currently, this is a school-based activity. The schools don't have immunity if there's something that goes wrong. So by taking the immunity out, it just preserves current law. And we also took out the attorney fee provision because what we believed was that if there truly is a violation of the student's free speech rights, the student will be able to find, for example, an ACLU attorney or someone who will help them assert their rights without attorney's fees. And by taking out the attorney fee provision, we also thought that that would help keep people who don't have a legitimate claim from bringing a claim. So we took out the attorney's fees provision. We took out the immunity, which preserves current law, and we added a statutory $100 statutory damage. And the reason for doing that is, if you recall, we had a discussion about the capable of repetition yet evading review doctrine, and we passed a bill that addressed that doctrine of mootness. But there was some question raised about whether that bill will be able to withstand challenge because the underlying decision was based on the Constitution. And so by putting the statutory damage in, it's just nominal. It's $100 statutory damage. That will keep the case alive. The reason that the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals were mooting the cases is because it was for injunctive or declaratory relief. But by having the damage provision, that will address that issue as well. So it's kind of a win-win-win situation in that we took out the attorney's fees provision, so students who don't have a claim won't be bringing the claim. They'll have to find a volunteer lawyer to help them, and we preserve the immunity. Under current law, there is no immunity. We preserve the law under immunity. So that's taking that section out. Another thing that we did, and I'll just jump ahead quickly, is that we added to the college section the same section that was in high school about nothing in the section may authorize content that's libelous or slanderous or constitutes an invasion of privacy. So.
Go ahead. Ms. Bennett. Okay, thank you. Ms. Chairman, Chuck Bennett, Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Ms. Chairman, we are responsible for several of these amendments, 1, 3, and along with Representative Galizio, 4. Ms. Chairman, we had hoped initially that your passage of the bill regarding mootness would resolve this issue. In the process of sort of looking if that didn't satisfy this issue, we moved on to trying to indemnify a school district against potential student action under the change in the rules that would result as a function of the bill. Ms. Chairman, in talking with Representative Galizio and probably doing what should have been done in the first place, a very careful reading of the bill, we came to the conclusion that there is enough policy breadth in this bill to allow us to control the kind of thing we were trying to indemnify ourselves against. And with the decision to exclude advertising, which is often covered by separate contracts between school districts and advertisers, we felt, and particularly with Representative Bonamici's language, we felt that this is a bill that we can certainly operate with. We still are interested in this mootness issue, but this is not a bill that will cause us, I think, any great concern across the board. I talked with a number of school districts about it. Most of them are well beyond this level of free speech for their students and free expression in their newspapers. I was surprised to discover how really well resolved this issue is by existing school policies. So we certainly, I would go along with Representative Galizio's representation of this as a consensus position.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. As Mr. Bennett said, we're responsible for the dash ones, the dash threes, and working with Representative Galizio's office, the dash fours. After we sat through a lengthy hearing in your committee dealing with obscene material for minors, where you talked at length about Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, we found that parts of our dash ones probably wouldn't meet constitutional muster, so we have pulled them back. That was an interesting discussion and harkened me back to law school days and my bar exam, and I started to get the cold sweats in the committee room. But as Representative Galizio has commented, the dash fours are ones that are consensus amendments. We do need to eliminate editorial control for students over advertising, because our school districts have entered into contracts with advertisers across the state that say anytime a publication is put out by a school district, it shall have advertising in from certain advertisers. So we need to be sure that we honor those contracts that we have, and we wouldn't want that. But I believe the language that Representative Galizio and Representative Bonamici have put into the dash fours, which are a combination, a little bit of the dash threes and most of the dash twos, are consensus amendments.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make two more comments. We were visited by a group of students from the Beaverton Arts and Communication Magnet Academy, which is where my daughter and Senator Avakian's kids go to school. And the students wanted us to expand this bill to include artistic expression. And if you think we had a hard discussion about the Sauer Law or defining obscenity, we told them that that was fine, but that's not going to happen in this bill, and they should go talk to their school administrator. And I also forgot my prop, which I had with me on Friday that I was going to share, which is the school newspaper that came from the Arts and Communication Magnet Academy when the students went back to their school and started talking about this issue. And the cover of the newspaper says, "Censor our paper." And there's a very great discussion in there that the students are having in their school newspaper about censorship. So it has sparked some interesting discussion among the students.
Mr. Chair, one more comment, because I was listening to the proceedings of the first, and I think Representative Cameron had some important questions. I just wanted to reiterate something that's in the original bill that stays in, which is, I don't know if you have a copy of the original bill in front of you, mm-hmm. on page 2, lines 19 to 22, where, lines 19 to 22, where it says, a school official, and I'm beginning in the second sentence, a school official must base a forecast of material and substantial disruption on specific facts, including past experience in the school and current events influencing student behavior, and not on undifferentiated fear or apprehension. So, for example, in the terrible tragedy that took place in Virginia, that's certainly a current event. And arguably, if a student journalist had an idea to do something that was really seen as incredibly objectionable and problematic and could cause real disruption, I think this part of the bill allows the school to say, look, this would cause substantial disruption, and we're basing it on this specific current event. So I think it does take into account real circumstances, but the reality is, I think overall this bill attempts to put responsibility on the shoulders of students. It really will teach them instead of infantilizing them, and will provoke great discussions, and I think it'll be a strong symbolic comment that this legislature wants to train and educate young student journalists and treat them in a means that shows that they have some degree of maturity, with the idea that they're also under the supervision of a media advisor.
Representative Kahn.
Thank you. Council, is our lines 19 through 22 in or out with the amendment that's being proposed?
They're in.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Galizio, I appreciate your comments in regard to that section on lines 19 through 22 and page 2. And I'm wondering, however, if forecast of material and substantial disruption on specific facts and influencing student behavior, not on undifferentiated fear or apprehension, will be subject to interpretation, because there is no clear definition of those facts, and we seem to rely on clear definitions being set forward. So,
sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, and I wouldn't mind turning this to Mr. Bennett or Mr. Green, but my amateur understanding of law would lead me to believe that it's always under some degree of interpretation, and there's going to be judgment. I do think, though, that sentence where it says you can take into account current events influencing student behavior and specific facts, I think that does give the administration sufficient latitude. So, but I think it's a fair question. I don't know if
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, maybe I can help out a little bit. The sentence that Representative Galizio references, it modifies the language above on lines 13 through essentially 18, because what you look at in lines 13 is that nothing in this section may be interpreted to authorize expression by students that is liable or slanderous, constitutes an unwarranted invasion of privacy, or so incites students as to create a clear and present danger of, and then it goes into A, B, and C, and what Representative Galizio has referenced is large C there. And we believe, in talking with our council and school administrators, that the language from 13 all the way to 22 gives the adequate protections that school districts will need. What school districts will really need to do, however, is focus on their policies as it relates to student journalism, working with somewhat, and we'll put out sample policies for school districts. That's one of the things the Oregon School Boards Association does. We make this available to school districts so that it will fit these issues. I think you need to read that entire subsection 4 in total, as opposed to just pulling out 19 through 22, because I think it covers everything, and it's going to focus more on those policies, so that, you know, you have to have a clear and present danger of the commission of unlawful acts on school premises. And I think that's where we talk about that horrendous thing that happened at Virginia Tech, or what happened at Thurston so many years ago down in the Springfield School District, a violation of school district policies. And that's where you're going to focus on school district policies and where it may incite students. And then material substantial disruption of the orderly operation of a school. And that's something that's a standard that school districts deal with right now with regard to students acting out in class, certain curriculum things, that the classroom and the activities that have to occur need to occur. So you can't have it so that it's so disruptive that it disrupts the educational program. And I think that's probably something that Representative Comp can comment on as an administrator and how that works.
Thank you, Mr. Green. I had read line 13 as I was moving into that section. I was just concerned that undifferentiated fear or apprehension might be variously interpreted.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici.
I move that we adopt the Dash 4 amendments to House Bill 3279.
Representative Bonamici moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 3279. Any discussion of the motion? Any objection? And the Dash 4 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3279 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 3279 as amended by the Dash 4 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. In discussion, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'd like to say that I have a degree a long time ago from one of the finest universities in the nation in journalism, I think. However, I'll be opposing this bill. I'm not sure what we're trying to do with the bill, if we're trying to provide free speech, or we're trying to protect from litigation the supervisors, if we're trying to protect from litigation the school boards, the student advisors. I also have a conflict with this committee here. We're hearing, and I think probably going to support internet bullying, but we can't you know, put restrictions on the newspapers. I think this is also an example of it should be local control. The school, I think school districts, we heard from a, remember the student from Representative Smith's district in Eastern Oregon that said, you know, talked about the quarterback and how the paper criticized the quarterback's performance and that that wasn't good. Also, we're using, this is not, you know, I remember Representative Cameron talking about the fact that all newspapers have censorship by the people who own that newspaper. And the taxpayers of Oregon own the newspapers of the schools that are the newspapers from the schools. Also, I did a little bit of legal research in that looking at the how the Supreme Court has ruled on free speech. And it talks about to justify discipline for student speech, school officials have the burden to demonstrate that students' conduct would materially and substantially interfere with the requirements of appropriate discipline in the operation of the schools or impinge upon the rights of the other students. The material and substantial disruption part of the test remains the standard by which courts analyze most students' free speech. I think we, you know, we need to help our young journalist students. I was also on my high school newspaper and yearbook staff, but I don't think that this bill is necessary. I think it should be a local issue. The school districts locally should take care of it because you have different standards to our morale issues and standards within the different school districts. So I'll be a no vote. Thank you.
Any further discussion? Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, with freedom comes responsibility, and as a parent, I restrict my child's free speech all the time, and teaching them how their words impact others around them and can make a difference in making a positive contribution to our society and our community and to their friends versus a negative one. And I'm not sure, a little bit like Representative Wisnett here, I'm not sure where this bill is going from, but I would expect that my local teachers and school board and my local school would help me in that area of teaching my children the responsibility of that comes with the freedom of free speech, and until they're old enough to go out and suffer all the consequences for their actions when they would actually work for a newspaper that might fire them based on something they said instead of allowing them to come and sue the school district. So I'm going to be a no vote on this today.
I'll just briefly say, over 40 years ago when I was on the staff at the Vanguard at Portland State University, we had a newspaper that had a photo of Allen Ginsberg on it, who was nude, although it only showed him from the waist up and no private parts showing, and somebody was so offended they canceled that paper. We had to go, we actually went outside and printed it off campus and delivered the paper, and we all lived through it and survived. And so the thing that saves us from censors is usually their stupidity, and I think this is a good bill. I'm going to be an aye vote on it.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I, too, will be an aye. I think it is a good bill, and for some of the reasons that have been presented, we as school administrators have extensive policies. We have two big binders that are, you know, they're not a stick of statute books, I assure you. But we don't review our policies as often as we could and should. And I know I had a problem when I was a teacher at a high school and the administration basically went to the school board and said our students couldn't wear any hats, no coats, including their letterman's jackets. That one was a tough pill to swallow because I thought that infringed on people's right, and they had certainly earned their letterman's jackets. And so that was a number of years ago. It was just in the 90s. But I believe students, communities need to be addressing this and looking at it from their perspectives, and I hope this helps bring on that discussion. So I will be supporting the bill.
Further discussion? If not, then we have a motion before us, which is to move House Bill 3279 as amended by the Dash 4 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Clerk, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
No.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Prager.
Excused.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Rosnett.
No.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 3279 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Representative Galizio, would you like to carry that bill on the floor?
Thank you.
Yeah, very good. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3279. As I announced earlier, the House Bill 2890 will not come to public hearing and nor work session today. So we'll pass over that. And next bill up is House Bill 2740. I'll open a work session on House Bill 2740. And we need to get Council Stanford in, so let's stand at ease for a moment while we get changing of the guard here on Council. On House Bill 2740. Council Stanford, remind us about this bill.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 2740 relates to the crime of aggravated vehicular homicide. And I'll discuss it in terms of the Dash 1 amendment, which is what should be up for consideration today. There was also a Dash 2 amendment prepared that was a much narrower version of the bill, but the Dash 1s are what we'll be discussing and moving forward with perhaps today. House Bill 2740, again, relates to aggravated vehicular homicide. ORS 163.005 defines criminal homicide as when, without justification or excuse, a person intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence causes the death of another human being. By definition, it includes murder, manslaughter, or criminally negligent homicide. House Bill 2740 expands the definition of criminal homicide to include aggravated vehicular homicide. Aggravated vehicular homicide occurs when a person, acting with criminal negligence or recklessness, operates a vehicle while under the influence of intoxicants, and this results in the death of another person, and the driver has either, one, three previous DUIs in Oregon or statutory counterpart in other states within the prior 10 years, or two, a prior conviction for manslaughter in the first or second degree, criminally negligent homicide, or assault for second or third degree, and the victim's death or serious physical injury in the prior case resulted from the defendant driving a vehicle. House Bill 2740 also amends the crime of first-degree assault, ORS 163.185, to include circumstances when a person intentionally, knowingly, recklessly, or with criminal negligence causes serious physical injury to another while operating a motor vehicle under the influence. Again, if, only if, the person has either three previous DUIs in Oregon or the statutory counterpart in other states within the preceding 10 years, or two, a prior conviction for a first or second degree manslaughter, criminally negligent homicide, or first, second, or third degree assault, and in that case, the victim's death or serious physical injury resulted from the defendant driving a vehicle. There are also additional provisions to bring aggravated vehicular homicide in line with statutes pertaining to the seizure or forfeiture of vehicles involved in the offense, and also criminal driving while suspended or revoked statutes.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill, 2740, was the bill I introduced last session as House Bill 2828. It passed with 56 votes in the House. It went over and passed the Senate, came back, and it got caught in the in-game politics in the final days of the session, and rules weren't waived, and so therefore, because of that, it died. And I would certainly like to bring it back and have another run at this session with the Dash 1s.
Yeah, in committee there, you'll see some Dash 2 amendments which were prepared late last week in with the aim of reducing the fiscal impact so that it could the subsequent referral to Ways and Means could be dropped, but I've checked with the Speaker's office and that's not possible to do at this point, and so I think the preference is to move forward with the Dash 1s and then it'll go to Ways and Means and with and it may be scaled back in that process. Representative Bonamici.
I'd like to talk about the approach, and I'm sorry if you said this, so I had to step out. What was the approach for reducing the Ways and Means? What was the change that was made to reduce the...
Representative Bonamici, the idea was to, right now, in its even in the dash one form, it does two things. It creates this offense of aggravated vehicular homicide.
Right.
And then the other thing that it does, it amends the crime of first-degree assault to include what's presently third-degree assault, can bump it up to first-degree assault if it's an injury with a Dewey involved. The dash two got rid of that second prong. So the change to first-degree assault was done away with in the dash two, and it would solely have focused on aggravated vehicular homicide.
Okay.
I think Representative Barker, I don't think you made a motion on the dash
one. Mr. Chair, move the dash ones into 2740.
Representative Barker moves the dash ones into House Bill 2740. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the dash one amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2740 as amended with a prior referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2740 as amended to the the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
With a due pass.
With a due pass. Any discussion of the motion?
Just a question.
Representative
Barker. The reason it goes to Ways and Means is because it's a mandatory...
Because it has an impact on incarceration and the cost of our correction system. And we, if you'll notice, we passed out in the past week a number of bills that have a similar impact. And so what's happening is we're making a policy choice that, given sufficient resources, these are desirable things to do. But then, of course, the people who have to hold the purse strings have to figure out whether we can pay for it all. If there's no further discussion of the motion, then the clerk call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Cox.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Excused.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2740 moves to the Committee on Ways and Means. Close the work session, House Bill 2740, and open a work session on House Bill 2144.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 2144 is a product of the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force. It was before us originally January 17th and then again on Friday, and then here we are on Monday, on the 30th. It expands the crime of endangering welfare of a minor to include allowing a minor to remain in the presence of illegal alcohol-related activity. ORS 163.575 presently provides that a person commits the crime of endangering the welfare of a minor if the person knowingly allows a minor to enter or remain in a place where unlawful activity involving controlled substances is maintained or conducted. House Bill 2144 adds the phrase or alcohol to the above law. Thus, the unlawful activity that would give rise to the crime of endangering the welfare of a minor can involve controlled substances, drugs, that's current law, or illegal alcohol activity. Endangering the welfare of a minor is a Class A misdemeanor. It also counts as a one-half person felony crime for purposes of determining someone's placement on the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission sentencing guidelines grid. Two half person felonies would equal a person felony.
Committee, this bill was before us just on Friday, and we were short one member at that time, although we're short a member now. That's a little different mix. There were significant reservations expressed by committee members about this bill at the time. I would say it did not appear at the time that it had sufficient support to move out of the committee. But it's back because this is its last chance before our committee is today, so we need to decide whether this bill should be moved. Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe this is for counsel and maybe help clarify on lines 9 and 10 on page 1. I'm just trying to get to this, or alcoholic liquor is maintained or conducted. Is that referring to line 9 where remain in a place where unlawful activity? In other words, I want to be clear that... for example, somebody has minor children, they have a bar in their home, the liquor is displayed, and minor children are in that room. Would that fall underneath this, or alcoholic liquor is maintained or conducted? Or is it only if there was unlawful activity going on with that alcohol or liquor?
Representative Cameron, it's... is not the cleanest phrase, but my interpretation of the way that it reads, it would have to be illegal, unlawful activity. But let me say another word about that. It wasn't an issue previously with the statute, because if you talk about controlled substances, any activity
is illegal.
Right. It's a controlled substance.
Right.
And so now you have a phrase, alcoholic liquor, that is within this that is made to fit within this statute. Well, not all activity involving alcoholic liquor is unlawful.
Right.
So,
Counsel?
Yes.
But if we're inserting the phrase or alcoholic liquor, are we not making it an unlawful activity?
Representative Flores, it would...
And ostensibly, wouldn't that be an unlawful activity in your home?
My best interpretation, Representative Flores, of how this, the maxims of statutory construction, to use a phrase that lawyers like to throw out, is that you try to figure that try to make the statute work given the language that the legislature provides. And my best idea would be that it would have to be unlawful, what is existing unlawful activity involving alcohol. So what that would mean, I have a bar at my home and my teenagers' friends come over and I maybe allow one of them to have a drink, and therefore that's unlawful activity involving alcohol. I would in theory be guilty of the crime of endangering the welfare of a minor for not only that child, for my child is in the room, and for any other children that happen to be in the home.
And I don't even see that child under 16 or 18 would have to consume. It just permits a person 18 years of age or under to enter or remain in a place where an unlawful activity involving controlled substances or alcoholic liquor is maintained or somebody else is drinking it. So if we already have a sanction, why do we need another?
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is about the breadth of the language in this bill, although I definitely believe that there's a problem with underage drinking. I'm really worried about this one because, say, for example, I want to go to McMenamin's and get a sandwich, and I take my daughter in there, and she's not 18, and there's somebody in there who's using fake ID. So that's unlawful activity, and it's being conducted in there. But I knowingly take my daughter in there. I don't know about that. Did I break the law or not? I just think it's too broad to say that if you enter into a place where there's unlawful activity. I think you knowingly have to permit the person to enter. But I don't know if there's illegal activity in there or not. I don't know if somebody's drinking underage. And I think I might be accused of breaking the law if I take somebody underage in. That's just my concern about the way it's worded.
Representative Cameron, just reading the Attorney General's bill summary, it does state that the intent is, by adding alcohol, to provide statutory provision so that person endangers the welfare of a minor, he or she allows the minor to enter or remain in a place where illegal activity involving either alcohol or controlled substance is taking place. And I think, so their intent was, it's not the family room bar that the person is in a problem, but if there is something illegally going with the family room bar, and I guess Representative Bonamici's point of, I don't think they're after... they would get you if there was some minor that was being served there, but I think if they were involved in illegal alcohol activity is what the intent is getting at here.
But by virtue of this language, Representative, you're making it illegal activity.
Right.
And I think it could reach to the home. I'm concerned about this. I think if there's
what I'm sensing, committee, is there's not sufficient support for this bill to move forward. So I'm going to, then, with not hearing any action desired, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2144 and open work session on House Bill 2152.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, again, House Bill 2152 is also a product of the Underage Drinking Task Force, and it was before us January 17th and then again on Friday. This bill relates to the automatic, to the expedited suspension of driving privileges upon underage alcohol citations. And again, I'll summarize the bill briefly. Presently, ORS 471.430 provides that alcohol offenses by underage persons are Class B violations punishable by a fine and perhaps treatment or community service and perhaps license suspension. House Bill 2152 adds an additional element to such offenses, the immediate administrative suspension, with a caveat, of driving privileges for offenders between ages, and it says 15 and 20, but it should say between ages 15 and 21. The arresting officer, what would happen is the arresting officer would provide notice of the suspension at the time that the arresting officer cited the minor and would immediately seize the offender's license, even if it's an out-of-state license. The officer would then issue the offender a temporary driving permit valid for the next 30 days. If the offender wishes to appeal the automatic suspension, the offender would then have 10 days to file written notice with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Oregon Department of Transportation would then have to hear this appeal within 30 days. And there would be a mechanism set up where the officer would come in, et cetera, similar to what happens with DMV and Dewey laws right now. If unsuccessful, the suspension would become valid on the 31st day after the citation. Judicial review of the administrative appeal would be available. The suspension, the driving suspension period would be 90 days for first offenders and a year for any repeat offenders. An offender may obtain temporary hardship emergency driving permits in certain situations to cover the cost of administering the program. ODOT is authorized to charge fees in connection with reinstating an offender's privileges. And again, this would not, whether the offender was in a vehicle or not is irrelevant. It's just a minor alcohol violation would be cited and driver's license suspended.
Many of this, as you'll recall, most of you, this bill was before us on Friday and did not have sufficient support then to move, in part because of some letters that came in from several judges expressing concern about the bill. We rolled it over until today so to give people an opportunity to reflect on that. I think people have heard some input from their districts, may have heard some from judges. There may be further thoughts here. Where's the discussion today?
I'm Barker. Obviously, I missed Friday. I have heard over the weekend the principal from Lowell High School where we had our conference has contacted me. She's in support of it. One of the fathers from Lincoln High School who's involved in the drug prevention, alcohol prevention at Lincoln High School called me. He's in support of it. And my Multnomah County and according I secondhand, Multnomah County and Washington County District Attorney support it. I'm in support of it.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I need some clarification. We did have an email from Philip Tradel saying that as the judges from Marion County, Multnomah County, Clackamas County had interpreted this particular bill, and God forbid judges would interpret a bill. But he said that they're misunderstanding the intent here, and I'm wondering if the focus of the misunderstanding might be in sub 2 under section 2, where the police officer issues a citation to a person described in subsection 1 of this section. The police officer shall give the person a notice of intent to suspend and immediately confiscate from the person any driver's license or permit issued by this state and that grants driving privileges to the person. So there seems to be an immediate lifting of their driving privilege, and that was the sole focus of what these judges are saying. This is it should be up to the judges to make the determination whether the kid should have their driving privilege revoked.
If I may, the driving privilege isn't revoked. They give them then a receipt that they're able to drive on for the 30-day period up until they have a hearing.
I understand that, Representative Barker, but I think the language here is what gave the judges
I'm sorry.
Concern.
I misunderstood what you were...
Because it seemed to be an immediate taking of their privilege at the point of citation.
Representative Bonamici.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And I've had a lot of opportunity over the weekend to look at this bill, and I heard from probably the same parent, Lincoln High School parent, which, of course, there was the article yesterday about drinking Lincoln. But I tell you, as a parent of teenagers, I know that there's a tremendous problem out there. I have some concerns about this bill, though, that were exacerbated when I read it further. And I read the judge's letters, and I read Mr. Schradl's comment about it. But even the Department of Transportation letter about the bill talks about how the youth need only be cited, not convicted, for attempting to purchasing, acquiring, or possessing alcoholic beverages. The license suspension is an immediate penalty that takes place automatically among submission of an MIP citation form. So it is an immediate penalty. Your driver's license is being taken. You're given a receipt. So then it's up to the youth to go prove his or her innocence.
Right.
And I couldn't find anything in the bill, and maybe I'm missing something, that there's that this whole program is supposed to be funded and run through the DMV with the fee for reinstatement. I couldn't find anything that says if you prove your innocence that you don't have to pay the fee. One of the things that, with all due respect to our colleagues on this committee who were police officers, one of the things that concerned me about the administrative proceeding that's going to be run through the DMV or DOT, on page 5 of the bill, the police officer who made the report may present, this is at the hearing where the youth goes in to prove, to try to get the license back and to assert his or her defense. The police officer who made the report may present evidence, examine and cross-examine witnesses, and make arguments relating to the application of statutes and rules to the facts in the case, the literal meaning of the statutes or rules and issues of the, in the case, the admissibility of evidence, and proper procedures to be used in the hearing. And that's the citing officer who has that authority in the hearing. That concerns me. And then there was also an issue raised about the how this would affect low-income students. Well, there's an appeal process, and I tell you that the kids with the family income, they're going to appeal it. It's going to end up in the courts anyway. So we're just creating this additional administrative process. So I had some concerns about it. I also called my insurance agent at home over the weekend because I wanted to find out what happens to the insurance rate. And I explained this process that it doesn't have to be driving. Some kid can be standing on the corner with a beer. Doesn't have to be drinking the beer, just holding the beer. And they get their driver's license pulled and they're given this receipt. And my insurance agent explained that as long as there's something on the DMV record, that's going to affect the insurance. And there's been no adjudication of guilt or innocence at that point. So I'm concerned about it. I'm definitely concerned about the problem of underage drinking. And I know that there's some inconsistency in enforcement of existing laws, and I think that's where the focus needs to be, that we need to have more penalties. I also agreed with the judge who talked about the invincibility of teens. If I knew that what we're doing in here was going to help with teen drinking, that'd be a great thing. But teens don't think they're going to get caught. And so there's the whole issue of further communicating and educating teens about the consequences of what I hope will be existing law and making sure that they're strictly penalized when they're found guilty.
Representative Kump.
Mr. Chair, I respectfully disagree with my colleague. The impact that we have statistically that we can look at that young people do pay attention to the statutes and law is Measure 11. There was nothing that impacted the demeanor of our children in our schools at high school level more than Measure 11. It just put a halt to major violence, particularly gang violence. I believe this bill and the governor's task force, they have worked on this. They have recommended it. When you have children come into sixth grade that are already alcoholics, and we have to do something somewhere. And I'm not into penalizing people. I believe with this statute, they are given a citation. They can go and prove their innocence. It's a real difficult one, but right now, children, and I call them children, they're not paying attention. And this time of the year is just party heaven in colleges and high schools and, believe it or not, middle schools. So,
Committee, we've got several more bills to get through here, and I was hoping to finish it before floor session, which is actually at 11:30. So we've got a few more minutes, but we've got quite a bit of ground to cover. So I would like to complete our work so we don't have to come back later in the day.
I support the bill.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I'm concerned enough with the arguments that the judges have provided in their statements, and I think there's some confusion in language and the process here. I'm not salved by Mr. Schradl's explanation as weighed against the expressions of the court, so I can't support the bill in this current form.
Likewise. Mr. Chair, I move, discussion is done, I move House Bill 2152 to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2152 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
No.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Nope.
Representative Goff.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Excused.
Representative Reed.
No.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 2152 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Park, would you carry
yes,
that?
I will.
Close the work session on House Bill 2152. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2179.
House Bill 2179, thank you, Mr. Chair, relates to Oregon Department of Human Services. It was before us originally January 25th, March 15th. It was pulled on Friday, thinking that the amendments didn't do what they were supposed to do, and then that opinion was changed. So it's back today. ORS 181.557 provides a mechanism for a designated agency to obtain criminal background information from the Oregon State Police regarding individuals seeking agency employment or licensing or for some other permissible agency purpose. In short, present rules require that the requesting agency either provide prior written consent from the individual for such a criminal background check or provide proof that the agency gave written notice to the individual that the agency might request such a check. There are presently no exceptions to these requirements. House Bill 2179 amends this statute by providing for such an exception for one agency. It allows the Department of Human Services to obtain criminal background information regarding an individual without prior written consent or notice if that individual is the subject of a child abuse or neglect complaint, or if the individual resides at or frequents the residence of an alleged child abuse victim. In addition, there are dash one and dash two amendments. The dash one amendment, they both are before your consideration. Dash one amendment, the legislature continues to opt out of a federal standard relating to foster care and adoption assistance. There appears to be no financial consequence for this opting out. And I believe it's actually, by specifically opting out, you are still eligible for federal funding. The dash two amendment specifies that DHS must always notify the subject of a criminal records check. In the original bill, they need only notify a person if there was an actual investigation launched. The dash two amendment says, no, you always have to do so.
So, counsel, we would need both the dash one and dash two amendments, assuming we wanted the policy choice of always requiring notification.
That's correct.
You may recall the issue here before committee that the question was whether a criminal background check would require notice, and it requires advance notice under current law. As a result of passing this bill, would require not advance notice, but subsequent notice would have to be given under the dash two amendments. No notice if we didn't adopt the dash two amendments. Is that a fair summary?
That's essentially, yes. The only caveat to that, I would say, is that in the existing bill, if you subsequent notice would be required if you actually launched an investigation into the person.
Yeah.
But if you didn't launch an investigation, no subsequent notice would ever be required.
Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I was probably the most vocal one on this issue, I remember. And I think what my concern was is we were going from pre-notice to absolutely no notice, and the dash two amendments satisfy my concern to at least provide a notice of somebody that they've had a background check pulled on them from DHS.
Mr. Chair, I talked to Mr. Cerise about this after our hearing, and I support both the dash one and the dash two.
Representative Wisnik.
Could counsel tell me again, so by opting out of the federal standard relating to foster care and adoption assistance. Can you expand on that, please?
Representative Wisnik, yes, I can. If under the United States Code, Title 42, Section 671, it has to do with state plans for foster care and adoption assistance. And if you don't have this before you, but I'll subsection 20A and B are what is relevant. Subsection 20A and B, basically subsection 20A says states need to do something in a particular way relating to this issue, but then subsection B says
issue of background check.
Issue of actually foster care assistance.
Thank you.
Subsection B says subparagraph A shall not apply to a state plan for foster care and adoption assistance if the governor of the state has notified the secretary, and that should be like the assuming Department of Human Services, like the feds, that the state has elected to make subparagraph A inapplicable to the state, or if the state legislature by law has elected to make subparagraph A inapplicable to the state. So what House Bill 2179, the -1, is asking is that Oregon continue to do what it has done in existing law, and that's to make subparagraph A inapplicable to the state by specifically opting out. And I know that that's very generic. I can try to be more specific about what exactly we're opting out of.
It just seems like a strong statement. I understand we're not losing money, but
Harry, then Mr. Gilmore, why don't you come forward and amplify on that response?
Oh, I'm sorry. There's one thing that I'll say, and then correct me if this isn't right. The federal standards relate to the disqualification of a prospective foster or adoptive parent if that prospective parent has a conviction for child abuse, neglect, domestic violence, rape, sexual assault, homicide, or crime against children, or a conviction within the past 5 years for assault, battery, or any drug-related offense. Is that the issue?
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, that is the issue. Oregon has opted out of this federal provision that requires a certain standard when it comes to criminal background checks. And the original version of this bill terminated that opt-out by taking that language out of statute that specifically opts us out of that federal requirement. And the reason it did that was because the federal code is changing to eliminate that option to opt out of the federal standard. In other words, there's no longer a provision in the federal law that allows states to do that. The reason that we amended the bill to take that language out, in other words, to maintain the current status of us opting out, is because a work group had been formed to study the overall federal act that removed that opt-out provision. Now, since then, the work group has given us the green light to go in and change the law and specifically remove that opt-out. And so I know this is very confusing because we've gone back and forth with this bill. I guess the critical fact at this point is that another bill, House Bill 2190, was amended to fix this problem.
So we're going to opt out. We're not going to consider people have got those criminal records to be foster parents. Is that correct?
I apologize. I know this is confusing, but the effect of House Bill 2190, and that has passed out of this committee, is that Oregon will no longer opt out of the federal law because it's...
Okay. But we're opting out in this bill, but we're going to change it in another bill.
That's correct.
Well, okay, and I'm wondering whether that, how critical that is to our action on this bill.
Well, it's, Mr. Chair, we're saying we're going to opt out, and we don't care whether foster parents have a felony record or abuse record and something for 5 years. That's pretty... I'm concerned about that.
The -1 amendment to this bill, what it does is it just takes language out of the original version that that it deletes part of the bill, so the effect is null. The end result will be the change in House Bill 2190 will go forward, is my understanding.
Is 2190 opting, continuing to opt out of the federal standard?
House Bill 2190 will bring us into the federal standard. It takes away the language from current statute that
we're passing one bill, it takes that allows us to opt out. Another bill that puts us in.
I got to admit, I don't understand that. Opting out and opting in.
which takes effect, which is...
Yeah, what's the timeline on? Well, this takes it out of the bill.
It just takes it out of the bill. It doesn't take it out of the law.
In fact, the bill...
It just means that another vehicle is going to accomplish...
Another vehicle has been used. That is correct.
Okay.
To put us back in.
Okay.
Yes.
To be in.
Okay.
So that, and this bill, the amendment just removes that language that was in this bill that's already being accomplished in a different bill.
That is correct.
What is important is that Oregon is going to opt in, and through 2190 is opting in. So the standards, the federal standards about you can't be a foster or adoptive parent if you have certain types of convictions, those we are going to follow in Oregon.
That is correct.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, you need a motion?
We do.
I'll move the dash ones and the dash twos to House Bill 2179.
Representative Cameron moves both the dash one and dash two amendments into House Bill 2179. Any discussion? Any objection? And the dash one and dash two amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2179 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves the House Bill 2179 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Monahan?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Cox?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wizard?
Aye.
Chair McPherson?
Aye. House Bill 2179 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We have a volunteer, Representative Cameron. Thank you very much for carrying that bill. Close the work session of House Bill 2179. Instead of these for a moment, we determine where we're going to head next. Going to go next to House Bill 2327. Open a work session, House Bill 2327.
Chair, members of the committee, you have in front of you the dash three amendments. They are the bill. It creates the crime of subjecting another person to involuntary servitude in the first and second degree, with first degree set as a Class B felony and second degree as a C felony. Creates the crime of trafficking in persons and sets a penalty as a B felony. Allows the victim to seek restitution for a conviction. For a convicted defendant for the gross income of the value of the defendant of the victim's labor services or the value of the victim's labor services computed using the Oregon minimum wages. Includes the crime of involuntary servitude and human trafficking within Oregon's racketeering statute. Allows commencement of civil actions up to 6 years rather than 2 years after conduct constituting human trafficking occurs. Creates a civil cause of action for damages against a person involving in trafficking. Creates a civil cause of action for damages against a person involved in trafficking, allows the victim to raise a defense of duress when the victim was forced to commit a crime, creates a task force in trafficking in persons, includes when the crime of theft by extortion, threatening to notify law enforcement of a person's immigration status unless the person pays money or some other form of property to the person making the threat, includes when the crime of coercion, notifying law enforcement of a person's immigration status unless the person engages in conduct which the person otherwise has a legal right to abstain from doing.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Committee, I'm Jeff Barker, State Representative, District 28. Representative Roblin was to be here today, but is unable to make it, and he asked me to pass this on to you. These amendments create the crime of human trafficking in Oregon. Human traffickers, also known as coyotes, are at the bottom of the barrel, but Oregon's legal system doesn't recognize the problem. There's a scourge on decent, law-abiding Oregonians and Americans, and it's time we put a stop to this deplorable practice in Oregon. Coyotes bring immigrants across the border legally, usually under subhuman conditions. With the false promise of good jobs and substantial wages, they sell the dream of a better life, but it rarely works out that way. In the worst cases, Illegal immigrants, often women and children, are left in the deserts of Arizona and Texas with no food or water or shelter, and they are left there to die, and they often do. In the best circumstances, they're loaded into semi-trailers like chattel and trucked throughout the country. They arrive in Oregon and other states hungry, thirsty, cold, and homeless. Coyotes have collected his payment and is gone back to the border for more unwitting victims of this modern-day slave trade. Our laws dictate that we should spend time pursuing illegal immigrants, but they ignore the facilitators. They ignore those who make illegal immigration violations possible, and worst of all, they ignore the fact that all this takes place in the most horrid conditions imaginable. Sometimes these coyote operations are well-coordinated, far-reaching, and highly profitable enterprises. Sometimes they are small one-man operations. But in all cases, they prey on the desperate circumstances of their victims for monetary gain. Let us be clear. All willing participants in illegal immigration trade are culpable for their actions. We cannot simultaneously condemn the actions of coyotes and defend their victims. By crossing the border illegally, they too have broken the law and should be held accountable. But we can assign particularly grave consequences to the worst offenders who violate not only the law but the standards of human decency. Their violations are grotesque. The conditions they provide are inhuman. And if we continue to willfully ignore their presence in our state, we too are guilty of perpetuating this deplorable practice. The black market in human beings is profitable, and in Oregon it carries little consequence. Colleagues, I urge you to adopt House Bill 2327 as amended and help put an end to this terrible practice. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barker.
Chair.
Representative Wisner.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, did we have a public hearing on this bill?
There was a public hearing on this bill, and it was
a tap
chair. Members of the committee, this is one of the bills on Friday that we bet you tapped in. There was no one signed up. You tapped the bill in, no one signed up, tapped the bill out. That's
so there's basically, you had a tap, but no public input.
It was noticed 72 hours in advance of that, but you're right. This is a gut and stuff bill.
Mr. Chair, the next question would be that I think I signed on to sponsor a bill that did the same thing. Are we going to hear that bill, or has it been worked into this bill?
Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, this is very similar to a bill that came out of the Senate and is in Ways and Means Committee, plus the additional elements of coercion. That bill was worked, and that reflects it in here as opposed to the other bills that were filed earlier that did not have that same kind of work. What happened originally, there were bills that were filed last session that were based on a quote-unquote a model that came from Washington, D.C. That model was not very well put together, and we spent considerable time over the interim tightening the bill up and tightening the language up. That is reflected right here.
Chair, I guess I'm just concerned is hopefully working with you. I didn't know anything about this because, like I said, we had other bills that were introduced by, I think, Representative Flores, and I signed on that during this session. It was not done during the interim. And here we are at the last minute of the last day. And, how do you argue against it? But my point is I would have appreciated to know what we're doing or how we're consolidating these bills. I don't know. Did we have the gut and stuff on Friday, or did we just have it scheduled? What's the date on? No, we didn't. This is dated the 30th, so we didn't even have.
We didn't have the dash two.
Yeah.
Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, we had the dash two amendments. I read the dash two amendments. There were problems with the dash two amendments. I sent them back to the Legislative Council's office to make technical changes to the amendments. The one thing I was concerned with some of the issues, whether they fit within the relating clause as it relates to civil cause of action, had redrafted civil law.
I think the situation is that we've had a tremendous volume of bills here over the last 2 weeks. You know, we've had a lot of activity, and this one here, we were going to have a hearing and work session on Friday. We had time to do tap in a hearing and tap back out. So there was no time to spend on this bill, so now it comes up here 25 minutes before we're due on the floor. And so it is a human trafficking bill, which I think is an important issue, and we think that and it does have a subsequent to Ways and Means, so it's getting something that's a policy statement on this issue into the hopper so that Ways and Means can consider the fiscal impact.
I have a question of counsel.
I read the dash twos and I haven't had a chance to read the dash threes. So I don't see a definition section in the dash threes that is like the definition section in the dash twos. And if you could sort of point out the differences between the dash twos and the dash threes.
Okay, Mr. Chairman.
I read the dash twos and not the threes.
There are a couple of differences. One, in section two, it originally listed as a class A felony. That was different from the bill that passed out of the Senate. It was different from the bill that came from the work group. And what they did is they took an earlier version of the bill, and I got the amendments from someone else. Okay, they came to our office. They intended to focus on the bill as it passed out of the Senate. It did not. Okay, that was changed to make it comparable to the bill that went out of the Senate Judiciary Committee to Ways and Means Committee. The other issue that's in here is that going over to page, on page 15.
Of the dash threes or dash fours?
This is the dash three amendments. On page 15, line 19 through 22, in absence of conviction, the plaintiff in a civil action bears the burden of proving elements of this act by a preponderance of the evidence. Okay, the other bill was relating to human trafficking. This bill is relating to crime. It has a civil component to it. I was concerned that as originally drafted, that civil component, the ability for someone who's been a victim of human trafficking, could then file a civil lawsuit seeking damages, that this did not fit within the relating clause. I had discussions with Legislative Counsel's office after reading the amendment on Friday. I spoke with them, talked to them. The language was changed to make it more defensible that, in fact, it does fit within the relating clause. Okay? The other difference you will find between this and the bill that passed out of the Senate is in Section 11 and Section 12, and that is a person commits theft by extortion when the person compels or induces another person to deliver property to a third person. And it adds an additional element in line 19 to page 16, notify law enforcement of the person's immigration status. Okay, then to 12, a person commits a crime of coercion. And going over again on page 15, page 17, notify law enforcement of the person's immigration status. Those issues are similar to what the human trafficking bill is. And that's why I believe they were put together this way.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. I mean, we've all been very rushed. I got the amendments Friday. As I said, I read them and found them to be different from what came out of the Senate and found them to be technically, legally flawed as it relates to the civil aspects of the bill.
And committee, I don't want to rush action on this bill, but we do have two bills from the Representative Nathanson's here for, and I still want to go to work session on the campus security bill, 3318. I know is important to members of the committee as well. And I was hoping to conclude all of that before 11:30.
So are we moving the dash threes or the dash fours, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it would be the dash threes.
The dash fours
do not have the language that makes it a better argument that the civil aspect fits within the relating clause or relating to crime.
Representative Barker, do we have a motion on the dash threes?
Mr. Chair, move the dash threes into
House Bill 2327.
2327.
Representative Barker moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 2327. Any discussion? Any objection? And the dash three amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, move the House Bill 2327 as amended. When they do pass, did you say to Ways and Means?
To the Committee on Ways and Means.
To the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2327 as amended from the committee with a due pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion of that motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
House Bill 2327 moves from the committee to the committee, from this committee to the Committee on Ways and Means. I close the work session of House Bill 2327. I'm going to open a work session on both House Bill 3251 and 3369.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3251 comes to you from Representative Nathanson. It has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee. Requires the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to administer a grant program that encourages collaboration between local agencies and organizations involved in the criminal justice system. And 2369 has the dash one amendments with it. Requires a county that has a local public safety coordinating council to publish annually a report describing the status of local government criminal justice systems.
So Nathanson, why don't you come on ahead and you can discuss the status of these two bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Following the discussion at the initial public hearing, there were several people who testified in favor and also a couple who had questions and concerns about how the bills would be implemented. Subsequent to that, I spoke with Mr. Dennis Smallville, representing, he's a government affairs officer representing Washington County, that had provided a letter with some issues to the committee. I had a very productive meeting with Mr. Mulvihill and have submitted some amendments for your consideration. I think that we made a lot of progress in my understanding that county's concerns, and that county understands the scope of my objectives with presenting this bill to the committee, and it looks like we've worked things out. I certainly hope that we have, because it appeared to be that way as of last week. So you have some amendments in front of you, amendments to House Bill 3369, which do indeed clarify and draw in the scope of responsibility to boards of county commissioners.
And no amendments to 3251?
That's correct.
See? Okay. And I don't see Mr. Mulvihill in the audience. Is there anyone else here on behalf of the counties or Washington County in particular? See, I do see Paul Snyder here from the Association of Oregon Counties.
Chair, I don't have the amendments.
Dash one amendments here. 3369. Just to 3369.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. There was a representative from Washington County here just a few minutes ago, but I believe the issues that Representative Nathanson has described have been fairly well addressed in her amendments, and my sense would be that Washington County would be of the same opinion.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, we talked, and I thought I was okay on this, but let you know I did get an input from my county, and they're opposing it. I'm sorry.
Okay. Any further discussion about these two bills?
Just
Representative Cameron.
Is there a referral to Ways and Means?
3251 does have a prior okay. referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 3369.
Representative Bonamici moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3369. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the dash one amendments are in House Bill 3369.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3369 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 3369 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just a quick clarification, Mr. Chair. As I understand it now, with the the dash ones, that this, rather than an annual report, it's an annual summary. So I'm sorry, I failed to see a whole lot of the distinction. Is it the depth of the issue that's covered, Representative Nathanson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Flores, yes, that's correct. The amendment changes the language. The concern was that some might consider a report to be a very extensive and lengthy document requiring a lot of analysis or research and writing responsibilities on the part of the Board of County Commissioners. That language has been changed to clarify that rather than all of those program changes that respond to or impact the recommendations, it's just program service and program issues that respond to. So it did take out a few words and phrases that were substantive that the counties felt might draw them into a lengthier process. This really narrowed the scope of what they're going to be providing a summary of.
Any further questions or discussion?
I believe I made the motion.
Yeah, I think you did. I think we have a motion to move House Bill 3369 as amended to the floor with a due pass. If there's no further discussion, clerk, call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici,
aye. Representative
Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores. Aye.
Representative Call.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Excused.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
No,
aye. Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 3369 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Nathanson, would you carry that bill on the floor?
I will, thank you.
Very good. I know we're still in work session on House Bill 3251, which has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3251 to Ways and Means with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 3251 with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion of that motion? If not, call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Flores. Aye. Representative Cox. Aye. Representative Krieger. Excused. Representative Cox. Aye. Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Nay.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. House Bill 3251 moves to the Committee on Ways and Means. I hold to the work sessions on House Bill 3251 and 3369. I'll open a work session on House Bill 3318.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3318 comes to you from the Committee on the Judiciary. You have the Dashbone Amendments in front of you, too. It allows the State Board of Higher Education to authorize institutions under its control to designate one or more of its employees as public safety officers with the same authority as other peace officers. Eliminates the position of special campus security officer. The Dashbone Amendments require the State Board of Higher Education to authorize each institution under its control to commission six or more of its employees as public safety officers. Has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee.
Committee, you'll recall our hearing on Friday. Actually, Representative Barker was excused that day, but the rest of us heard the input about this proposal. Any discussion of the bill?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Bonamici.
What struck me about the public hearing was that the schools that have relationships with their police departments, like Eugene, the University of Oregon has a contract with the Eugene Police, and Oregon State has a contract with the Oregon State Police, those seem to be working well. And so I struggle with trying to find out a way to solve this problem. I know, you know, there's a lot of crime on some college campuses. I frankly feel like I don't have enough information to be supportive of moving this on to Ways and Means. I think it's a huge issue. I don't know what the right policy is, but hope they can sort it out over there.
There is a fiscal impact, which, of course, Ways and Means would have to grapple with in both the training aspect, as we heard on Friday, because of longer training regimen for campus police, and it may also have other impacts in terms of how they staff. And that's in an environment where our university system has not so far been faring well in the budgetary process. So it is troublesome to be adding cost for their operations at the same time that we have historically over the last decade or two been shorting them rather substantially. Representative Cameron.
Mr. Chair, I thought the testimony was great to hear from the Chancellor and the model that is presented at Oregon State University as a combination. But it was real clear and evident that there was security and there was law enforcement with that was armed, that was on our campuses, and there was a concerted effort. And I think this is a big enough issue that we should send it to Ways and Means to be discussed, to bring it to the light. Being a member of Ways and Means, we are constantly hearing about the need for more public safety officers in throughout all of our state of Oregon, and this might be another one of those vehicles that allows the Ways and Means group to take a look at how do we provide for some of those increased needs, whether that be state police, whether that be local law enforcement, or what have you. I think this is a real important policy issue to send down to Ways and Means to consider.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I know I already spoke, but in reviewing my notes, because the Oregon University system, the chancellor is in opposition, I believe I would feel much more comfortable moving it without a recommendation.
Chair, Representative Wiseman.
Was this amendment a consensus between the officers at the university that wanted this and the university system, and also the, I don't see a representative from the...
No, I would say these amendments, the dash one amendments to the bill, predate the well before the hearing we had on Friday when the university system was expressing opposition. Is there something more to add to that? Okay, very good. I think committee may be given the sort of mix of input we were getting that moving it to Ways and Means without recommendation may be the most appropriate consensus we would reach here.
Mr. Chair, I'm fine to move it with a due path recommendation. I think this is a public policy discussion and a public safety discussion. Public safety should be our number one priority, and safety of and security of students on campus is a significant priority. I think that the university system and the gentleman from Oregon State University underscored the argument of having armed safety officers on campus was working well, and it's a policy decision I think that we could make in good conscience to say we should pass this and let it be viewed accordingly.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd move to amend the motion with a due pass to Ways and Means.
So we did have a motion.
I don't think there was a motion.
What I will understand that to be then, Representative Wiseman, is a motion to move House Bill 33. Well, actually, we have not adopted the dash one amendments. I will understand your motion to be to move the dash one amendments into House Bill 3318. Representative Wiseman moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3318. Any discussion? Any objection? And the dash one amendments are in. Representative Wiseman?
Mr. Chair, I'd move House Bill 3318 as amended to Ways and Means with due pass recommendation.
So, committee, we have the issue of whether we're going to move this with a due pass recommendation or not. I think we can tell there's some support for due pass. I'm feeling more neutral about this. I think that I would prefer not to have the due pass recommendation on this motion.
I reiterate my concern because the policy choice, although we all want students to be safe on campus, there's a way that's working at some of the schools is whether we create this entire new university police department. And that's, I feel, we need to put to Ways and Means. I'm not ready to say that that's the right approach, and I would prefer without recommendation.
Representative Barker.
And I'm sorry, Ms. Friday, but I support sitting with a due pass. The fact that we don't have state police on patrol, I know they're getting paid out of a different pocket down there, but when we don't have people patrolling and I see guys running around with the coach on football day, I'm going, state policemen with their, I'm going, wow, it's time for Oregon to move on and have real police on campus, and that's what this bill will do.
I like it.
Okay. Then we have we have before us a motion to move the House Bill 3318 to the floor with the due pass. Due pass recommendation. Representative Forrest?
I'll take it to the floor for you.
it's going to Ways and Means by prior reference, but the motion before us is with a due pass, and there's some concern about that. But I don't hear a motion to amend to remove the due pass.
Mr. Chair, it would be futile for me to do that because the expression seems to be in the committee that wouldn't make a difference.
On the main motion, then the clerk will call the roll.
No, for the reasons I stated.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Representative
Frazier.
Excused.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett. Aye.
Chairman Forsyth.
Aye. House Bill 3318, as amended, moves to the Committee on Ways and Means to close the work session on House Bill 3318. Committee, there's only one bill that we did not open a work session on, which was House Bill 2766, Representative Lim's bill about underage drinking. I brought it forward because it interacted with or overlapped in subject matter with 2152, which we did move with a due pass recommendation. So it's my intention not to open a work session on that bill on the ground that we've covered that subject as it is. But when we adjourn this meeting, that means that that bill and every other House bill that is pending in our committee, which is in the hundreds, dies. So I just want to make sure people are aware of that.
If the only thing I would say is this is actually different, and what 2766 does is goes after the kids or underage people trying to buy liquor at the stores. The stores pay a dear price if they sell, accidentally or not. People lose their jobs and so on. And I would like to see some of that burden that Representative Lim has brought to us shifted back on the people who are violating the law in the first place, attempting to buy liquor. And I would like to see us move this today if we could.
Okay. Are we in a work session, Mr.
We're not. Okay. I have not opened the work session, but if there's a consensus that people would like to spend a couple minutes.
It's a begging to open the work session.
Okay, I will open a work session on House Bill
2766. Thank you. Mr.
Yeah, and we don't have counsel here who worked the bill. I would say, committee, I will not support this bill, but if the consensus of the committee is they want to move it forward, but I will be a no vote on this bill. But I did want to bring it back because I
appreciate
that. Didn't want to preempt the kind of policy choices that the committee wishes to make.
Mr. Chair, if I could just say, this imposes a fine of $350 for a first conviction, if be convicted, and a subsequent fine of $1,000. These have serious the illegal purchase of alcohol has serious effects on the stores and on the employees in the stores, and if you can afford to go buy beer and wine, you can afford to pay a fine if you're underage, I believe. And I think this will have a true detrimental effect on people going and trying to buy wine. I think it will be good for business in Oregon.
Representative Cameron.
Ditto.
Okay, well, we have a couple strong opinions.
Does it have a subsequent then?
No. It does not, because it is a fine, so it does not.
Okay.
So it does not add to incarceration.
Okay,
no,
thank you. Right.
There's no incarceration.
Next stop is the floor if we move it out of the committee.
Mr. Chair, it's been all since we heard this. Would you please articulate your concerns about the bill?
Well, my concern about it is that increasing the fine for attempting to buy alcohol underage is I think an ineffective kind of way of trying to shape the conduct of adolescence. I think that while I had some misgivings about the license suspension bill 2152, I felt that would have a greater likelihood of actually shaping the conduct of minors. The increase in a fine that already exists, and it's already a fairly stiff fine, to make it even stiffer just means we're going to hit some families, the parents will begrudgingly end up paying that fine. In other instances, a juvenile will be, or a young adult will be fined at a stage in life when that's pretty difficult fine to pay. And I'm wondering how effective it will be at shaping people's conduct.
Mr. Chair, conversation I just had with my 19-year-old daughter this weekend, who would fall into this category, she's pretty heavily influenced by her financial condition and the actions and the choices that she makes. And I would say that, maybe it does raise the consequences or the fine for that, but it does get the attention of people when they know that they behave in a certain way, it might cost them a little bit more money, and I really believe that this is a fine that can be avoided by somebody just obeying the law, not trying to break the law, and it's a pretty simple, straightforward thing for a minor to do, not buy alcohol.
Mr. Chair, what's the current fine?
I've known this. Well, $350 and $1,000 is what it's changing it to.
Right.
The question is, what is it now? And Darian Stanford.
In the bill summary, it says currently Class B violations carry a maximum fine.
A maximum of $360.
Just again, I just think this offsets the same kind of penalties that we impose on the grocery stores. So, we hit them pretty hard. So I think that we need to balance it back. I've heard that from my local merchant two sessions ago complaining about that.
Yeah.
Do we have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would like this bill better if it wasn't mandatory, because there's no discretion based on circumstances. The judge could be reviewing a situation that didn't really warrant that amount, and that concerns me about it.
I believe that putting the name judge in front of a name does not bring great wisdom with that, and I'm willing to go with mandatory
in some circumstances.
Maybe we're past the start of the floor session, so we have a motion before us.
I move with the due pass.
Representative Barker has moved House Bill 2766 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? You know how I feel about it, committee. Clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici.
No. Representative
Cameron.
Aye.
Representative
Flores.
Aye.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
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 No. Motion carries. House Bill 2766 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Representative Bark, would you carry it? That concludes the work session on House Bill 2766 and all of our agenda. Committee, thank you very much. We will be meeting at 8 a.m. Here for the indefinite future, but we should have less pressured agendas. I will now adjourn the meeting of House Judiciary.